This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Hard Traveling Fanboys first edition of the new year. It's a brand new year, 2017. Nick Duke and I are here at our lush studios, recently redesigned in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and we are here to bring you our latest journey into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's right, it's the Hard Travelers for Hire. And as you can tell from that intro, we're debuting something a little bit different for the new year. We're going to start out the show with our quote-unquote main event of the evening. And in this case, that means we're going to start off with our movie review. And before I get to our special guest on this occasion, let me say that I hope you all had a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy New Year. And that brings me to my partner, my cohort, my amigo, what the French call a certain I don't know what, Nick Duke. How are you, good sir, on this wonderful nondescript evening?
I'm doing very well, although your glowing words for me are filling me with apprehension and suspicion. I don't really know what you're driving at here, Phillips.
I'm turning over a new leaf in 2017. I'm no longer going to antagonize you. I'm no longer going to accuse you of being an anti-Archite or a pro-Potterite or any other such word. I'm going to be your friend, Nick Duke. I'm going to be nice to you. You're going to be nice to me, and we're going to have a much more genial, some might say boring, version of the Hard Traveling Fanboys in 2017.
Well, sounds good to me. I love being boring. You know that.
That's right. And in full disclosure, folks, I am feeling a little bit under the weather this week. So Nick's going to be talking more than I am probably this week, which means the world will finally get what we've all been waiting for, what everyone's been waiting for, Nick Duke talking more. So you're going to enjoy that. But more importantly than all that,
go fuck yourself.
We want to welcome our special guest for the evening. And he is the most special of guests because he's the guy that you don't see behind the curtain. He's the engine.
Well, being that this is an audio show, they don't actually see any of us behind the curtain, Greg.
But they can imagine what we look like with our Brad Pitt and, I don't know, Matt Damon-like physiques. And they can imagine what we're like while we're
sadly, we're more like Jonah Hill and even fatter Jonah Hill.
Yes, that's probably accurate. Or like members of the Hutt family. But in any event, the guy, the engine that makes this whole Place to Be Nation pop machine run, he is a member, of course, of our PTBN West Coast connection. Todd Weber is joining us. Todd, thank you so much for being on with us here in the new year.
Greg, Nick, it truly is once again an honor to be here and representing the West Coast of Place to Be. Blah, blah, fuck. Good morning, good afternoon, and good night.
Well, off to a rousing start.
Yes, I love it.
and Todd is joining us today to talk about everyone's favorite blonde-haired, blue-eyed, hammer-carrying, low-key smashing, Natalie Portman smashing superhero Thor, the God of Thunder. And no, we're not talking about any of those knockoff Thors that you might have seen on the Sci-Fi Channel. Of course, we're venturing into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and we're going into, I believe, the fourth entry in the MCU, and that would be 2010's Thor. And we're going to be talking about this movie, and as always with Hard Travelers for Hire, we're going to be watching the movie as we discuss it. We're probably not going to get through the whole thing, maybe, you never know. But we're probably not going to get through the whole thing. But what we're doing is we're kind of reminding ourselves of scenes we want to talk about, maybe performances that we want to highlight or just you know, things to spark discussion if things die out. So you're welcome to watch along with us. We are all currently sitting at 000 on the Blu-ray or DVD or digital version, however you're watching it. Anything else, Nick and Todd, that the listening audience needs to know before we get cracking on Thor?
The only thing I can think of is that when it comes to these Marvel movies, for the most part, I am able to maintain some aura of objectivity when it comes to analyzing these things. But when it comes to the two Thor movies, that goes out the window because I am a self-professed massive Thor mark, so to speak. And I am particularly I'll call it a mark for Chris Hemsworth. I don't really know what else to call it. Let's just say that, you know, if you were uncomfortable with the noises that Greg and I made every time we saw Scarlett Johansson during the Iron Man 2 podcast, you might just want to turn your volume down a little bit during this one as I watch it, because that's my one. That's my one. And before it gets any more awkward, Todd, you?
Well, I'm not going to go exactly there, but I will say he looks darn good in street clothes. How about that? We'll talk about that. Iron Man 2 also had a post-credit sequence that led into this movie, did it not?
Right. Yeah, it did. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes, it did.
With Coulson in the desert,
found in the valley or the crater in the desert there by Philip J. Coulson and his SHIELD companions, who we at the time didn't realize would go on to become really boring on television.
Well, these weren't, to be fair, these weren't his, you know, the SHIELD companions of the television show quite yet.
No, that's true. That's true. This was pre really douchey Phil Coulson.
Pre-death Coulson is the best Coulson.
Mm-hmm. I would argue that there shouldn't even be a post-death Coulson, but that's just one man's opinion that we can get to at a later time. In any event, yes, leading into this movie, as Todd mentioned, there was a post-credit scene at the end of Iron Man 2. This movie was kind of another one of those Phase 1 Marvel movies that some would consider to be a risk. Kind of an intergalactic type character that is out there even by comic book standards. Granted, it's based on Norse mythology, but I would argue that most of the American viewing public is not as familiar with Norse mythology as it is with Greek mythology or even Roman mythology. So it's a bit out there as a concept, and This was something of a risk going in, as something of a diversion from the typical superhero fare, at least in theory.
Yeah, I would say that in terms of the domestic audience, I think this Thor movie was probably the riskiest movie of Phase 1. And then, you know, next month we'll talk about the most risky from an international standpoint was probably Captain America, just because that's a tough sell, you know, overseas. But this one was always the one that I knew they were going to try, and I just kind of was unsure as to whether it would work or not. I absolutely wanted it to work, but, you know, it's a tough ask. I mean, there's a lot of, whether it's the Shakespearean language, like as you mentioned, the mythological trappings, or just kind of some of the general, I mean, I'll admit it, some of the general hokiness of the concept. I personally did not see audiences buying in nearly as much as they did.
Yeah, and, you know, this movie has a lot of stuff to get across, as I'm sure we're going to talk about. They don't necessarily do a whole bunch of setup with, well, this character is the big fat guy, and this character is the Robin Hood lookalike, the dashing swashbuckler. So, yeah, as we'll see, this movie kind of just jumps into the middle of things and gives the audience a lot of credit for following along.
Right.
Right. Well, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, the three of us are going to all hit our play buttons. We're going to count you down, and you're welcome to hit play along with us and watch Thor as we do, and of course we'll let you know when we cut it off, and as we typically do, we'll probably watch the rest of it when we're done with the podcast, or we might get through the whole thing depending on how frisky we're feeling. So in any event, we're gonna hit play in 3, 2, 1 play. And so tell the audience your histories with the character of Thor. Todd, I want to start with you. You, I know, are a big proponent of the Walter Simonson comics, predominantly from the 80s, I believe. But tell me a little bit about your history with Thor and where he ranks in your favorite superheroes.
I guess Thor, to me, has only been as strong as his creative team. I think I first really I knew about Thor as a character because of his Mego figure back in the 70s. And you would see once in a while he'd show up on, like, the Amazing Spider-Man TV show, or, you know, Spider-Man and his Amazing Friends. There it is. And but he was, I guess, the first comics I ever read that had him were the first series of Secret Wars, where he was off world with the Avengers and taking them all on. And then there was a random day walking to school that I had some change, so I bought an issue of Thor, and I believe it was 375 or 350. It must have been 350, which is right in the smack dab in the middle of the Walter Simonson run where he was fighting Surtur, the fire demon. It was really awesome, and I think I was kind of hooked from there. Although I didn't add it to a comics pull list, I didn't have a pull list back then in eighth grade, I still kind of read it on a regular basis, and I really appreciated the Simonson art and writing specifically. Enjoyed Beta Ray Bill, enjoyed the Thor Frog, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then didn't really spend a whole lot of time with Thor as a character unless, you know, somebody I really liked was doing a run of it. But and then I got again big time with Jason Aaron run, but that he's always kind of been there. There's always been Thor there in the Marvel universe when I'd read him. Trying to think some other instances, and I guess, was he a part of Heroes Reborn? That's not, I guess, yeah, he was, because yeah. Rob Liefeld drew a really bad version
yep.
of him.
Yep.
He didn't have quite the same measurements as Captain America, though.
No, which is weird, because, yeah, he's even bigger. He's a god, for instance. He should have even a larger chest.
That's the true measure of one's immortality, is the size of your chest, I've found.
Imperial chest. So, so in the movie, we see, who are these ladies in their RV?
Yeah, this is kind of a weird opening for a Thor movie, you know, like,
yes.
I was kind of thinking coming in that I think what the subsequent scene that we're going to get here in just a minute, which is kind of the flashback to ancient Norse times with Anthony Hopkins kind of giving you, you know, in brief, the whole mythology as best he can, you know, in a very, I mean, that's a lot to pack in there, but you know, that I feel like they did a pretty good job. It's kind of like the opening of the Green Lantern film, if you remember, where they had Tomar Rae of all characters giving the voiceover at the beginning, talking about the entire history of the Green Lantern Corps. And I mean, it's some heavy stuff to dump on an audience in such a short span of time. But to get back to your question, Greg, about, you know, my experiences with Thor. Thor was a character, you know, I didn't read comics regularly growing up, but whenever I would pick up a comic off the rack or see him on the cover, he was always a character that appealed to me for whatever reason. I'm not really sure. Maybe it's because I always found lightning powers to be really cool when I was a kid. And then when I finally got into reading mainstream comics, you know, it was the Ultimate Universe, and obviously the Ultimate version of Thor played a big role in Mark Miller and Brian Hitch's The Ultimates, which as we've discussed on this show and in the column before, you know, that was always one of my favorite series. And then when I finally made the jump over to mainstream Marvel into the 616 universe, that was during a time where Thor was kind of off the table. They had the clone version of Thor they used during Civil War, and it wasn't until about, 6 months or maybe even a year after Civil War ended that they decided to bring him back with J. Michael Straczynski's run. And that was pretty much my first, you know, 616 exposure to reading a monthly Thor title, and I absolutely loved it. I've always recommended that JMS run to people who haven't read it, you know, and pretty much since then, even if I haven't had it on my pull list, I've always at least been following the character, whether it's through trade or just kind of making sure I'm abreast of the monthly events. And, you know, to echo what Todd said, the Jason Aaron stuff over the last few years has just been, in my opinion, the best run in the character's history from a creative standpoint. It's never been a better time to be a Thor fan between the Hemsworth portrayal on the big screen and the extremely high level of quality we're getting from the comics right now.
I forgot how much I really liked the Ultimate Thor, and I wish they had done more. I mean, the way they present Thor in the Ultimates was so clever.
Agreed.
I give Mark Miller a lot of credit for that, and I wish, I don't know, I kind of wish that was the actual version we got, although he is clearly influenced by that version at times in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right. They're very much, I mean, we'll get into this a little bit later, but the whole, you know, the god fallen from Asgard onto Earth and nobody really believes that he's who he claims to be. The whole storyline they did with him in Ultimates 2 is by far to me the best part of Ultimates 2. I generally prefer the first story to the second one, but they give Thor a much meatier role, and you know, the whole question of mental illness is just a really cool take on the character in that book. But here we're going to get on screen right now our first shot of Asgard, the Realm Eternal. And I got to say, for me, I remember, Greg, watching this with you in the theater the first time we saw it. And it was the first Marvel movie I'd ever seen in 3D. And as someone who's not generally a fan of 3D, I thought at the time the 3D effects really added something. And in general, I was pretty impressed with the level of CGI and the level of set design and detail they were able to bring to this. All the Asgard stuff looks beautiful from start to finish.
As we'll discuss later in the film, I'm sure, and in subsequent films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's almost that Green Lantern syndrome where everything on Oa in that movie was really good, although there wasn't nearly as much Oa in that as there is Asgard in this.
Right.
But the Asgard stuff here is so great, is so different, is so beautifully rendered that it almost hurts the film when they go to Earth because it just can't compare. This, I totally agree with you, Nick. The first time we saw this, I was just marveling at the visuals of Asgard. See what I did there? The CGI was great. Kenneth Branagh just is at his, you know, I guess in heaven doing these Asgard scenes, because this is like right off of what Kenneth Branagh would like to do. Shakespearean in nature, the Loki and Thor relationship, I think he found far more interesting than the Thor and Jane Foster relationship, which I would say the audiences did as well. And the movie is at its best with what we're seeing here, with the give and take between Thor and Loki, and with the politics of Asgard, if you will, which can sometimes weigh down the comics, but here is done to good effect, I feel. I really enjoy this entire segment of the film as they're establishing the history of Asgard.
And one of the biggest questions I had coming into the film is answered right here, as they actually did do the helmet, which I was convinced they weren't going to do. And they did it in a very ceremonial way, which makes it feel somewhat, you know, in context and not out of place, if that makes sense. It doesn't feel cheesy in a way that I thought it would if they tried to do it all the time. But you mentioned Kenneth Branagh. I guess we should talk about that. Somewhat of a unique outside the box choice to direct a big budget superhero movie, wouldn't you say, Todd?
I would say that. I think Kenneth Branagh was brought on not for the action, because he didn't have really a track record as that, or the effects, being an effects driven director necessarily, but because of the higher level of drama and perhaps being a different kind of dialogue that you would expect. Although, his specialty was always Shakespeare stuff. And in Thor, you have a tale that's, you have a couple, and I'm not going to be Aaron George here, the actual Shakespeare expert, but I will say, you know, you can definitely see there's an influence with King Lear, where you have the son, the father who's about to distribute his kingdom among the sons, and you have the rivalry there. Plus, you also have a version of Henry V, which is Branagh's actual breakthrough, was directing and starring in Henry V in the late 80s, and which is a tale about a unproven king-type figure who has to kind of find his way and deal with things. So that's kind of what we have to see the journey that Thor takes in this film. But I do like this. This is like a coronation scene, basically, that we're going through. And the first time we see the adult Thor, the only time he wears the helmet in the whole movie, right, Nick?
Right, yeah, I believe so, yeah. He may have it on at the end, whenever they're having the big celebration again. I don't know if that's the case, but I'm pretty sure, you know, he never wears the helmet in action. And to my knowledge, has not worn the helmet while doing Thor things, for lack of a better term, in any sort of action scene in the MCU to this point.
His
dress has had some subtle changes here and there, but I would argue that he's probably been the character in the MCU whose costume has kind of remained the most consistent from movie to movie, unless you count the Hulk, which I don't suppose you would in that scenario.
Yeah, and sometimes you see him with the arms up, the arms down, bare-armed or covered armor.
Right.
But it's been pretty consistent.
Yeah, you're right. The kind of the chainmail kind of deal on his arms has probably been the biggest thing that's changed from time to time. But, you know, we're talking here about the coronation scene as Thor is preparing to assume power, assume the throne of Asgard from his father Odin. And that's one thing I wanted to touch on already. You know, in a movie that is filled with relative unknowns in Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston, what a coup by Marvel to get Anthony Hopkins to slum it up for a little bit and do Odin. I was blown away by that casting when it was announced, and I think he goes big at times in this one. And again, in the Dark World, but I have thoroughly enjoyed Sir Anthony Hopkins as Odin throughout these pictures. Greg, what were your thoughts when that casting was announced?
Yeah, I was a big fan of that casting. Anthony Hopkins, his voice, it's just that distinguished, regal voice that you would expect from Odin. To the point where now, whenever I read Odin in the comics, I hear Sir Anthony Hopkins' voice. Whenever I read it. So it's one of those roles that, even though, you know, it's not spectacular, he doesn't do anything that reinvents the wheel or anything, but he's Anthony Hopkins, and Anthony Hopkins just always has that sort of commanding voice that just makes you respect him and makes you think of him in that almost royal kind of way. So it's an appropriate fit for Odin, and he's done a fine job in these movies with what he's been given, even though he hasn't played, you know, perhaps as massive a role as he has in other films. He's been a very important addition to this cast of characters. And again, he helps these Asgard scenes have gravity, have meaning, and adds even more reasons to why I enjoy the Asgard stuff. As opposed to the Earth stuff in these Thor movies.
Yeah.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, yeah. One little thing I just noticed during the scene that we're watching, I don't know if it's the way they've shot him or the costume they have him in, but he also looks a lot more physically imposing than you typically see Anthony Hopkins do in most of his films. It seems like they really, you know, made an effort to make him look big and bulky so that he would, you know, seem like he could hold his own with Thor, or seem like that he could be somebody who could sire such a beautiful man as Chris Hemsworth.
So I'm going to say now, looking back, he hasn't changed all that much as far as costume, but his hair has evolved. If we can put a fine point on that, his hair looks much, much better these days. Here, it's not quite a mullet, but it's just awkward. It's like he's growing it out long for the first time.
Right.
It hasn't really reached its peak. But yeah, Todd, you're going to have to be the first guest on David Sunday's Celebrity Hair Podcast. he is a big aficionado of the celebrity hairstyles.
Oh, look, it's the Warriors 3 and Lady Sif.
It is. It is. Big fans of the Warriors 3, and I know Greg is a big fan of Volstagg in particular.
Me too.
Oh, yes. Volstagg is my favorite of the Warriors 3. I just love him because I relate to him, because he just wants to eat all the time, you know. And who can't relate to that, really?
I'm just sad they couldn't possibly find a way to do the comics version of Volstagg where he's so impossibly fat that you sit there and wonder how he even like walks around at any given time.
Blob from the X-Men.
Very much like Blob. Yeah, that's what they should have done. Is just gotten the dude from X-Men Origins Wolverine, I suppose.
Here's another one of my favorite parts of the movie. First of all, the casting here is really good. One of my favorite parts of this movie, Lady Sif, and the MCU, in fact. I think she's one of the most underrated parts of the MCU. They've done so well with getting her across the badassery of her character. I had never read anything about Lady Sif before I saw the Thor movie, because I never read Thor comics when I was a kid. I didn't know who she was or why I should care about her, but I thought that this and the second movie and her brief role on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. did so much to make her a compelling character that there are times in these Thor movies where I kind of wish that the movie was about Lady Sif instead of Thor.
Well,
yeah, I mean, Jamie Alexander does a great job, and it was a great piece of casting. I would argue, you know, you said underrated. I think even though, like you just mentioned, she's one of the few actors or actresses from the films that's been allowed to cross over to the television universe, I think she's vastly underutilized. I mean, there are entire subplots that are pretty big parts of the Thor mythos, you know, most notably the love triangle between her and, you know, Jane Foster and Thor. And you get small hints of that, but the only hint, the only hints you get are, you know, kind of her doing longing looks from time to time. But there's a lot of material to mine here with Sif that I'm afraid they're never really going to get to, considering the fact that the upcoming Thor Ragnarok, from what we've been led to believe anyway, is mostly going to be taking place outside of Asgard. So a lot of untapped potential with Sif, in my opinion.
Yeah, we also have the Valkyrie coming in the next Thor movie. So
it's a great point.
You know, we may not see a lot of old Sif, but I would argue – I think there's better chemistry with Thor and Sif than there is with Thor and Jane in this film. I don't know.
Totally.
I would agree.
You know? Totally. You are completely right. The first time we saw this movie, I said the same thing. I was like, I think I even remember asking you this outside the theater. Like, why on earth would Thor even have an interest in Jane Foster from what we're given in this movie? Like, given the complete lack of chemistry that they have, the lack of personality that Jane has in this movie, and given how Sif is charismatic, obviously attractive, a badass, cares about Thor clearly, which he doesn't seem to see, to me it's a no-brainer. Absolutely, Todd. They should have – Thor is a fool for not pursuing that.
Yeah. Couple of things that I wanted to point out here, just in this scene in particular. What an awesome – job by Kenneth Branagh, Kevin Feige, and whoever came up with the entire like reconceptualization of the Bifrost. Because in the comics, if you're trying to explain the Thor mythos to a newbie, to an outsider, and you say, well, it's a bridge made out of a rainbow and they walk across it, you know, it's one of the hokier things, I'll admit that. But they do a really cool job here of kind of redefining it, and then also getting Idris Elba as Heimdall and the version of Heimdall they choose to bring to the screen, this guy who is literally all seeing and has this like almost this impossible weight on his shoulders as a result of that. It's a really cool interpretation of that character. And I would argue, much like Sif, he's been a character that's pretty much stolen almost every scene he's been in throughout the MCU to this point.
I also love the fact, crucially, that we're seeing the Asgardians go on a mission, and we're seeing them as they are in their natural element before we ever see, you know, Thor go to Earth and deal with all the fallout of his issues with Loki and the splintering of the group and all that. It's a mistake that too many movies make. Again, I always compare this movie to Green Lantern, and I don't know why I do that, perhaps because of the similarities with Asgard and Oa and intergalactic characters and all that.
Well, did they not come out in the same year?
And they came out they came out a year apart. I think Green Lantern was 2011.
Thor was 2011 as well.
Oh. Okay. Well, then they both came out in the same year. But this did what Green Lantern attempted to do right. Because in Green Lantern, we never got to see the Green Lanterns bust bad guys, basically. We saw them fail at the beginning of the movie. We see Hal fail throughout the movie. And then we see them, you know, miraculously defeat Parallax at the end after the entire Green Lantern Corps has basically been decimated. Here we get to see the Asgardians go on a mission and do stuff and show kind of their combat skills and how things work in Asgard normally before humans get involved.
And this is kind of like Rogue One, where the you know, how they sneak off and go on the mission anyway without permission, and that's what Thor's doing. He's taking the Warriors mm-hmm. 3 and Sif and Loki to exact some revenge against the Frost Giants, or what are they hoping to accomplish
right
here?
Yeah, so during Thor's coronation was interrupted by a pair of Frost Giants who broke into Odin's vault seeking to regain Lothi's crypt, which was the weapon that was being
right.
Yeah, the casket, yeah, being shown used in the opening of the film. And so Thor considers this essentially an act of war, an act of aggression on the part of the Frost Giants. He thinks that they have broken the truce that Odin and Lothi came to so long ago. And being the hothead that he is, he wants to go in and basically whoop some ass and take some names. And this is what we're doing here in Jotunheim, which is a pretty cool realization of the Jotunheim of the comics. Bathed in shadow a little bit too much, in my opinion, because it's kind of hard at times to make out what's going on during the sequence, but all in all, pretty cool set design on the part of the filmmakers here.
And there, it feels like
this guy looks. Oh, go ahead.
It feels like they're borrowing a lot from the comics version of the Dark Elves for this part of it. They didn't have the confidence that there would be a sequel and that they'd get to bring the actual Dark Elves in.
Right.
Just as far as just the the general temperament of the Frost Giants. There's more of that, and some of the artifacts and things that they handle. Although it's nice because this gives you a lot of insight into the Loki story.
Right.
So you also get the shadowing, as you mentioned, the idea that Thor is a hothead and that he's not a flawless character by any means.
No.
You also get a rather Ivan Ooze / Apocalypse looking creature here that leads the Frost Giants.
Yeah, I'm not gonna knock on that one. I actually kind of like the design of the Frost Giants here in this film. So, but yeah, like Todd said,
I'm just saying this guy looks awfully similar to the design that they went with for Apocalypse in the X-Men Apocalypse movie.
Right. Well, this was,
which looks similar to Ivan Ooze
5 years preceding, but nonetheless. Yeah, and so you kind of get this idea here of Thor's ego getting in the way, and I kind of like the little smile from Hemsworth there, because it's clear that he was not pleased with the idea of walking away peacefully, and that they pretty much gave him exactly what he wanted here, which was an opportunity to let off some steam, Bennett, so to speak.
Right. He enjoys the thrill of the battle. He's a warrior through and through at this point, and shares a lot in common with John Matrix, actually, from the classic Commando in that regard.
Yeah, especially seeing that as how his major love interest from the film, you know, Natalie Portman and Radon Chong give about, you know, equal performances, I would say.
Absolutely. Oh, and
that's
are about
brutal. Fuck.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get there eventually, but. No, this is cool here, getting our first kind of glimpse at Mjolnir and all the things that he can, you know, kind of pull off when he's in action. I really like this action scene. Like I said, I think it's a little dark. I've watched it on a lot of different screens at this point, whether it be in theaters or at home or now on a computer. And that's just, unless you turn your brightness way up, it's kind of hard seeing, you know, what the hell's going on here. Although that's also really cool, showing how Loki can be effective in battle.
Loki's deception, right.
Really because cool. too often in Thor comics, he's kind of treated like the Joker. And what I mean by that is not really a physical threat in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And there needs to at least be, you know, some level of menace about Loki that, you know, given the right circumstances and the right opportunity, he could potentially do some damage to Thor if he got the chance. But like Todd was saying, right here, the scene that we just saw, you know, very key to the Loki, the story coming up. And for those people who weren't big fans of the comic, should have been your first inkling that it was not as it seemed when it came to Loki and his true heritage.
So this is Fandral. Is that his name? Fandral from the Warriors?
Fandral.
And
Fandral.
He's the swashbuckling Errol Flynn type character. Oh, he just got impaled there. How about that? I was remembering him as – what's his name? From Zach Levi from –
Yeah, so Chuck. Zach Levi took over the role in The Dark World because this guy, who I'm having a trouble remembering the name of at
Joshua
the moment,
Dallas.
Joshua Dallas.
From Once Upon a Time.
Joshua Dallas got the role in this film because of a scheduling conflict with Zach Levi, who was intended to play the role in the first place. And it was thought at that point that the ship had sailed, but then when Dallas had some sort of conflict for The Dark World, they went ahead and made the move over to Zach Levi, and, you know, kind of a seamless transition, in my opinion.
Poor Josh Dallas, though, man. Yeah. Getting left behind after playing the role in the first one. But yeah, no, he's a. It's interesting how many Errol Flynn takeoffs there are in comics. I say how many. I know of primarily two.
And that was freaking.
Thor just did the spinning hammer. Yeah,
just did the spinning hammer.
I mark out for that every time because you see that in the comics. So you've imagined that your whole life, and then you see it.
Yeah, and like, you're like, how would that actually work in real life? Like, and you're seeing it, and it looks awesome.
And now you can't imagine Thor using the hammer without swinging it around. At least I can't. Really good. Really good. Now, who is this guy?
This is Hogan, the third member, the third of the Warriors Three. He was always kind of – so the idea was that Volstagg was the glutton. You had Fandral, who was kind of the ladies' man and the charmer, and then you kind of had Hogan, who was the stoic kind of brooding member of the Warriors Three, and those were kind of their distinct personalities.
Well, you know something, brother.
That would have been even better, my opinion. But, you know, beggars can't be choosers and all that. This is also a freaking awesome little scene right here that's about to take place is this giant frost giant thing is about to get dealt with, yeah. so to speak.
This part is a kind of evocative of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, which is a great comparison because I mean Thor at its best. If you're gonna delve really into the political and the you know the royalty aspects of it and the more fantasy based aspects of it, Lord of the Rings is a great comparison for what a Thor movie can be.
This is the equivalent of, speaking of Hogan, this is similar to Hogan pushing the giant off the roof of Cobo Hall to his apparent doom.
Yes, and then he came back later with a Band-Aid.
That's in the director's cut of Thor, by the way.
That thing comes back later in with a Band-Aid.
Well, and then there's Jimmy the monster truck fight.
The Thor monster truck fight. So good. I wish more people had seen it.
So
this is also a really cool Odin's six-legged horse popping up. Or 12-legged horse.
I love that when Odin shows up, there's like no question as to who's the most powerful person on the screen. Like,
yep.
He shows up and you're just like, okay, that's Odin. Everybody else can just stop doing whatever they're doing now. Even though he looks weary, apparently.
Nice references here to the upcoming Odin sleep, which was among the list of concepts I never thought I'd see realized in live action.
How does the Odin sleep compare to the Friday afternoon Nick Duke sleep?
They are both equally important to allowing their respective hosts to survive. I'll put it that way.
So here you see them getting ready for, what's to come, potentially.
Essentially, Lothi is kind of saying here that Thor has officially, reopened the doors to war, and essentially now that Jotunheim and Asgard are going to reignite their centuries old conflict here in the coming days, and so you're about to get a really really good emotional scene. The first time that you really get to see Hemsworth bring a level of dramatic acting to it that I was unsure he would be able to pull off, being largely unfamiliar with his work at this point.
Well, and he was virtually an unknown at this point. He was
right.
He was Kirk's father in the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
and that was pretty much all I knew.
Scene, yeah,
and that's all I knew him as. And I was watching the show True Blood at this point, so I was hoping that, I think his name's Alexander Skarsgård. Do you know that
right.
guy? Was going to be cast as Thor. I was hoping and hoping. And, of course, his father is in the movie as, the doctor. What's his name?
Eric Selvig.
Selvig. I always call that guy Bootstrap just because we've seen the Pirates of the Caribbean movies so many times. But, but Hemsworth, I sometimes can't get past the accent because as a German dude, I feel like it should be a little bit more this way to be Norwegian or German or something. But – physically, he's so good in the role and has so much presence in the role.
And a level of charm that Thor kind of has to have, that swagger, for lack of a better term.
So we're watching the cast out scene right now, and Hopkins pretty much improvised this whole scene, as I read recently.
Really?
They just let him go. Hemsworth starts crying. It's so powerful. They improvised a lot of this, and Branagh just got this great moment out of both of them for this scene.
Right.
I love it. Love it.
And it's probably the biggest that Hopkins goes in this movie in terms of, just kind of bombast in his voice and whatnot, but it's also got these quiet moments of introspection or what have you. And this is one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Absolutely. This is one of the best Thor scenes in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, this is – the bombast works. If you're going to do Thor, you have to have that. I mean, Thor,
right.
And it's you mentioned the accent thing, Todd. I think it's interesting, though. There's always been this kind of I don't know if anachronism is the right word, but there's always been this sort of contrast between the fact that it's a Norse mythological character who has always been written in Shakespearean terms.
That is true.
That's a good point.
Old since Jack Kirby in the 60s and Stan Lee. Mm-hmm. But – mm-hmm. Yeah, and meanwhile, Odin throws the hammer the other way.
Right, and it's kind of an interesting concept in going with the idea that the hammer receives its enchantment after the fact. So the impression that you get here is that essentially anyone could have picked it up before this moment that we had just seen. And it kind of adds this whole new, kind of like a sword in the stone dynamic to the story that hadn't really been done before JMS's run, which, you know, as we'll discuss, especially during this portion of the film. So J. Michael Straczynski's run on Thor was the run that introduced the concept of Asgard being relocated to above a small town in Oklahoma. And while this isn't Oklahoma, it's a town in New Mexico. They pull a lot of influence from that run. The shot specifically of the town going out and trying to pick up the hammer. That's all straight out of JMS's run. So it's interesting to see that, you know, essentially 4 years after it was written, it found its way on screen.
It's also, well, that's very interesting about the MCU in general, in that so many of these MCU films were based. There's a pretty funny scene where he gets tased.
What is Thor wearing? Here?
I have no idea. Where did he get the attire?
It's like he's
wearing. We're just going to assume the velvet sort of enchantment.
Velvet pajamas you got from your grandma when you were a kid for Christmas.
He looks like a pink nightmare.
So many of these MCU movies are based on more recent comics rather than the quote unquote classic, you know, Silver Age Marvel comics. There are obviously elements there, but, you know, like the Avengers movies are based on the Ultimates largely. The Thor movie is based on largely on JMS's run. I can't say the same for Captain America, but several of the first two Iron Man movies have a lot of elements of the more recent, you know, Extremis made its way into Iron Man 3, which is a pretty recent storyline, you know, I believe, from the 2000s.
Second Captain America is all Brubaker, or a lot of Brubaker. Right? Yeah.
Mostly so. Brubaker, yeah.
Yep.
This is kind of a that's one thing I wanted to mention. This is kind of a funny scene here in a minute. That's one thing I was surprised by, is how funny this movie was at times.
Oh, yeah. It's at its best on Earth. I talked earlier about how I didn't like the Earth scenes. I should preface that. It's really funny when it wants to be.
And Kat Dennings is really funny as as Jane's the intern. Oh, and there's JMS about to find the crater.
Yep. Oh, is this JMS in the truck? Okay.
Yeah, he's the first one that tries to pick it up.
That's awesome.
I never knew that, Todd. That's awesome.
The things you learn on IMDb.
I just like to imagine that you just have all this information stored away and can access it.
I've killed a lot of brain cells over the years, guys. I don't have it all. But yeah, this is J. Michael Straczynski.
Oh, totally is. You're right. Yeah. Never noticed that before. Wow. Cool, though, that they kind of allow him to be the first to touch the hammer in this scenario, since he wrote this entire, you know, like I said, sword in the stone kind of parallel.
This is such a key part of the movie, too, because we've talked about in some of these other movies, particularly The Incredible Hulk and Iron Man 1, the importance of introducing these concepts that to comic book readers are old hat, but the ability to introduce them to a new audience. And in this case, introducing the idea that it's not a matter of the weight of the hammer, that it doesn't really matter how strong you are, you're not going to be able to pick up Thor's hammer. I think they did a really good job with that here. Now we get to the characters in the movie that don't work as well for me, which is Natalie Portman and the scientist guy whose name I can't remember.
Eric Selvig.
Selvig, yes. You guys mentioned just a few minutes ago, and I've already forgotten. But it's just kind of boring and uneventful. And we've been harsh on her, and we're going to probably be harsh on her. I want to get this out of the way. This is in no way for me an indictment on Natalie Portman per se. No, she's a very good actress when she wants to be. She's had great roles, but I think that her performance in this is very similar to her performance in the Star Wars movies, where she just doesn't appear to be – maybe she's not given enough. She's clearly not given much of a role. And thus, because she's not given much of a role, she doesn't seem to be giving her all as an actress.
It feels like she's above the material. And I don't know if this is me projecting the real world onto this film, but, you know, like Star Wars, like, oh, I was in these great movies, these Oscar nominated movies, and here I am slumming. I don't know if I'm projecting or if it just feels that way. Plus, there's just no chemistry to me between the two characters, and that for me seals the deal. Whereas I think Gwyneth Paltrow, who's a very well pedigreed actress in the Iron Man films, gives a lot more of herself into the performance, contrasting with Natalie Portman here.
Completely.
And I would like to say that, you know, that would change over time, because Gwyneth Paltrow, eventually they realized they had this chemistry, but at the same time, she wasn't being given enough to do. And her role kind of gradually, you know, steps up from Iron Man to Iron Man 2 to Iron Man 3. The problem is
legitimately funny moment.
Yeah, the problem is that they tried to give Natalie Portman more to do in the Dark World, and it still didn't work. So I think it's mostly an issue of material, but at the same time, I agree with you guys that at times it can feel like she's reining it in a little bit. And again, like Greg said, not an indictment on her as an actress, just an indictment of her in this movie.
In this movie, her performances in these movies have been akin to the Star Wars movies, as we said, and it's almost like they go. You compare it to Pepper Potts, and it feels like because they have Kat Dennings there as the sort of comedic side character, they go to extremes, as you see the Stanley cameo. They go to extremes to kind of make her the super serious, super smart scientist lady. And they do that by telling you how smart she is.
Yes.
Which is never not annoying in a movie.
Well, and they tell you how smart she is, but then she also has to play like doe-eyed, stricken, you know, damsel stricken by Thor's attractiveness, essentially.
Yes.
Sorry. God. Watch. Let's listen to Nick drool here.
Anyway.
Sorry.
What do you think? I mean, Todd, if you had been around when Nick first read the rumor of Chris Hemsworth potentially playing Hulk Hogan in a biographical movie, it was like nothing I've ever been around or care to be around again.
So, big time Easter egg here as Donald Blake is there's a "Hello, my name is" sticker on the clothes they give to Thor. And Donald Blake was the original way they introduced him in the 60s. He was a doctor who picked up the hammer. How is he worthy to pick up the hammer? I don't know. I don't necessarily, you know.
I have to confess.
He didn't pick up the hammer. He picked up the cane that turned into the hammer.
But somehow he was worthy. And so far, we've had two people who were worthy, right? Did Cap pick it up, or it was just Vision and Thor so far, right?
No, well, Cap depends on how technical you want to get with all the Thunderstrike, Eric Masterson stuff.
No, in the MCU.
Oh, you mean
in the movies. Yeah. In the MCU. Oh, yeah, totally.
In the movies, it moved, but Cap couldn't quite pick it all the way up. So
Vision kind of plucked it out of the air.
Right. Oh, that's right, Vision. I forgot Vision grabbed it. That was an interesting choice on the part of the
I think the idea was because Vision was a soul who had no concept of evil, and so that was always what I got out of it.
I interpreted that he was just pure, so pure that he and worthy that he could do it.
But, right.
And that it got everybody's attention, certainly, which is what it was supposed to in the movie. Everybody suddenly accepts Vision as being awesome. So we're back in Asgard, and here's Jamie Alexander as Sif again, and everybody going, "Boy, I wish they'd cast her as Wonder Woman."
Which I'm not going to complain too much. Gal Gadot has been fine thus far, but one guy we haven't really talked about yet, and I think we need to because he's the biggest, besides Hemsworth, the biggest, most long-lasting and important character to come out of this movie, and that's Tom Hiddleston as Loki. It would have been so easy for them to do a one-note mustache-twirling version of
Caesar Romero Loki, essentially.
Yep. But
Sinestro Loki.
A Sinestro in the Green Lantern film, Loki, yes. But instead, they actually gave him some pathos. They gave him, you know, I think that early scene, as short as it is, of showing he and Thor together as kids is so important to establishing the fact that there's a legitimate familial relationship between these two. That you know, when the betrayal comes, even though if you're a fan of the comics, you know it's coming. You know it's inevitable. It still carries an emotional weight. And I would argue that's due in large part to Hiddleston's performance. Hiddleston is amazing in this.
Yeah. As good as everyone else is, Hiddleston is the star of this movie.
His character
in terms of performance. He's incredible.
He changes the most from start to finish and does the most transformative performance. And here he's blue now, which is pretty cool. He's revealed in his ice frost giant form. And we're having this last confrontation between he and Odin before Odin has to enter the Odin sleep. Yeah, he was apparently a friend of Branagh's and had done shows and plays with Branagh, so Branagh pulled for him to be cast.
Apparently, he actually came in and read for Thor first and wound up getting Loki. So that was an interesting thing. And you get another scene here with Hopkins being able to bring the dramatic moment, you know, and it's just he and Hiddleston emoting off of one another here in this scene is pretty epic in terms of acting ability.
Yeah, this shows such a different side to the MCU, because one of the complaints, whether valid or not, is about the MCU is that too often it doesn't take itself seriously enough, where there's not really ramifications, there's not really serious stakes or anything. And here you see two classically trained actors emoting in a way that you would not expect from a Marvel film. There's nothing jokey about this scene. There's nothing biting or sarcastic about this scene. This is just emotion. They're going for it, and they're expecting that the audience is going to buy into these larger than life characters having this very real father-son argument.
Dialogue here is outstanding. The
it really is. Yeah,
the interplay, the reactions from each other. There's a little bit of silence between each line that you get just enough time to chew on it. It's so good. Both guys, you can watch it on mute and just get the full effect too.
Mm-hmm.
But just tremendous acting. Probably the best acted scene so far, and we're, 15 films in at this point, if we look at the universe as a whole.
Yeah, yeah.
It's among them, yeah. This one, and again, the cast-out scene from earlier. I mean, that's the thing about this movie. I don't think, you know, in terms of action, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, it's probably the weakest of the movies to this point anyway. I think four movies in. But it also has a dramatic weight, and it has some legitimate moments where you are emotionally invested in a way that you haven't really been to in any of the other films to this point, in my opinion.
Let me ask you this. We've talked – this is my favorite Earth scene by far. This is awesome. I could watch this over and over again. This should have been all the Earth scenes. Thor – fish out of water Thor is my favorite Thor. Like Thor, when he shows up like he does in the Ultimates and he does not understand how contemporary society works, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, we're back in Puente Antiguo, which is Spanish for – anybody know? Old
– I have no idea.
Old Bridge.
Old Bridge.
So a little Bifrost, I think, reference there.
Nice. I do think that as we talked about in our Iron Man 2 podcast, I largely feel like they only set the movie in New Mexico so they could work in that Land of Enchantment line into Iron Man 2.
And Journey into Mystery. Well, if you see the sign, it says the Land of Enchantment and then Journey into Mystery. There's a little Easter egg sign going to this town, which is cool, which is where the comic store first made his debut.
Right.
And we had Kat Dennings has a Verizon phone, apparently, I think. Get our product placement.
Yeah, got to work in the product placement throughout these films.
These movies don't pay for themselves, especially at this point.
No, because as you know, something we didn't mention at the beginning of this movie, you get the Paramount logo. This one and Captain America: First Avenger are the last two that are distributed by Paramount. So,
oh, look he back there.
Understand Rhodes.
It says, "Welcome, home of the Vikings."
It surely does. Yeah,
which you know, another Thor reference.
I'm trying to keep my eye out for Walt Simonson, you said, who makes an appearance here, and I haven't.
I believe he doesn't – he's actually at home with among the Aesir in Asgard, not on Midgard. So we'll keep our
really?
Eyes.
Really? Okay. Cool. Okay. But yeah, so you got this whole fish out of water story like Greg was talking about. We've kind of knocked on Natalie Portman a little bit. We've talked about Kat Dennings kind of being the comedic relief. One thing that I'll kind of – venture away from Greg here is I kind of found Eric Selvig. I wasn't bothered by him. I thought they had some decent comedic relief moments with him later in the movie, especially as his relationship with Thor starts to develop. The drinking scene with them was fun, in my opinion.
Drinking scene was funny, yeah.
And they set him up for a bigger role in the Dark World, where he's pure comedic relief, and of course a key role in the Avengers as well.
Avengers, the beginning of the Avengers. So, yeah,
he serves a role. He's just. I don't know. The character is just not that interesting to me. Like I felt like the movie would have worked perfectly fine without any of the human characters involved. Like just Thor walking around interacting with random humans as opposed to a specific human who and now she goes from amazing scientist to blushing and 15-year-old, which who could blame her, honestly? Well, I mean,
imagine how more intolerable it would be if there was no Eric Selvig and she had to be the one to try to put across all the science. You know?
All the science, yeah. It would be even more of the Robert Kirkman. Let's sit around and tell everyone how smart this person is.
Hey, look, there's 7-Eleven. There's another product placement. I'm going to be doing that forever now. USA Today.
USA Today. The greatest of all newspapers.
And here we go with their first interaction with S.H.I.E.L.D., which kind of sets up, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D.'s involvement in the movie, which I got to be honest, felt a little forced to a certain degree, especially the cameo the first appearance we get of a certain Avenger later on here in the film, which was added at the last minute, apparently, to the point that Hemsworth and Jeremy Renner's Hawkeye don't even actually share. We're never on set at the same time while this movie was being shot.
Yeah, what I was going to get at earlier, do you think that at all that this movie chickened out on being what it could have been if the whole thing had taken place on Asgard?
You know, I'm of two minds about it because
Nick, your microphone is doing that thing again that it does sometimes where your voice fades out a little bit.
Nick's of two minds about this one, Greg.
I think that might be cutting into your intellectual property, Todd.
Sorry about that. So S.H.I.E.L.D. has taken everything away from Eric Selvig and Jane Foster and what's her name? What's Kat Dennings' character's name?
Kat Dennings' character, whose name I can never remember.
Darcy.
Darcy. Darcy. There we go.
Yes, not Marcy Darcy, but just Darcy. What was your response, Nick, to the thing?
We just saw the Journey into Mystery billboard for just a second from their view on the as they were sitting on the roof.
Right. I was just going to say that I'm kind of a little bit of two minds about it because, on the one hand, while I would greatly prefer to see the movie take place almost entirely in Asgard, and I know that that's something that, you know, more hardcore comic fans would be willing to accept. It's just you have that question of will the general audience, you know, be willing to buy into that? Personally,
it's
I think pre-Guardians
of the Galaxy world, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, in a pre-Guardians of the Galaxy world.
And how could you do it? I mean, you'd have to have, like, somehow a human ends up there and is the audience eye view member, and you'd have to tell the story that way because you're not going to sell that movie otherwise to a studio at this point, at least where
right.
we were here in the Marvel
world. Right, because Guardians really changed the whole game for, I think, what superhero movies could be accepted for. I do think that after Guardians, you could easily do a Thor movie entirely in space, entirely on Asgard, or what have you. And at this time, it would have been a huge risk. We said the same thing about Green Lantern, again, to compare it to Green Lantern, which, you know, as much as we gnash our teeth about how bad the Earth stuff is in that movie, they felt at that time it was thought that you had to have a superhero movie grounded on Earth to some level. So,
unlike Green Lantern, this one gets better each time you watch it. To me, does anybody
yeah.
else feel that way? At least,
oh yeah,
I would totally agree. Yeah.
The Asgardian stuff, especially the Earth stuff, stays about the same, or you notice a little bit more about certain performances. But the Asgardian stuff is like they got it right the very first time.
You can really get sucked into like just looking at the sets for the Asgard stuff. I mean, the little details and the level of love and admiration for the source material that went into that Asgard stuff. It's a beautifully rendered version of Asgard, and even though it's
the costume
somewhat
for
different
Loki
than
right
the,
here,
the commitment to the mythology they make is great. It's everything is gold, and you just have this lived in world that still seems better than ours. It's really awesome. And I just enjoy all the performances, all the weight that is given to the Asgardian stuff. And again, it just holds up. The performances hold up. The larger than life aspect of it holds up to me. And there's Jamie Alexander again, who is 10,000 times more compelling than Natalie Portman.
Yep. Absolutely. So, now we're at a library, the most exciting setting for a Thor movie.
Eric Selvig, briefly in that little rooftop scene, he was mentioning how they had S.H.I.E.L.D. had taken everything away from a colleague of his who was studying gamma radiation. Did you catch that one?
Yeah, you have a little nod to the Incredible Hulk, so. And you kind of have him here trying to, I guess, I don't know, point. I'm not really sure what his goal is here. Does he think he's going to get Jane to believe that Thor is a phony just because there's this other book, this little children's book or whatever? I don't really know what
it is. Hey, everyone, Thor's a phony. A big fat phony.
Hey, everybody, I'm the only actual Norwegian in the whole film.
And now you have Thor, this comical scene of him going into a pet store and asking for a dog big enough to ride.
Handsome. All the fish out of water stuff works well.
Handsome pet store employee with his sweater.
Yes.
And his afro.
His afro, yeah. And what terrible dialogue they're giving Natalie Portman. This. I've never done anything like this before. Have you ever done anything like this before? Like just I mean, you kind of understand why she might have reined it in a little bit.
Has any prominent, well-respected actress ever been given worse dialogue to read in big movies than Natalie Portman? Good Lord.
Yeah.
Younglings, Anakin! Laughable.
Well, they're both smiling.
Again. Yeah, running off the road because she's gawking at Thor.
Yep.
I could have
done
that.
They're smiling at each other. That means they like each other.
Yeah, clearly.
Oh, she'll see soon enough, eh?
Oh, we can't. And of course, we can't forget her big moment near the end of the movie when she gets to give one of the worst deliveries in the movie. The oh my god!
Oh, that's terrible. Which is a pun, which is funny, but
I get it. I get what they were going for. It's just
yeah, the same thing that happens to everything else when it gets hit by lightning. Toad.
Yeah.
probably could have done a couple more takes of that one.
The previously mentioned director's cut has her turn to the camera and wink and go get it. Which was a bit much, I thought.
And this is a really cool depiction of the Odin sleep. I like this kind of the golden aura surrounding him and whatnot. It's a neat deal. And you also get the criminally underused Renee Russo's.
She's barely in this film, unfortunately, and she's a great actress. She's terrific.
Yeah, barely in this film, and then barely in the Dark World as well.
I love her as Riggs's love interest in the Lethal Weapon movies.
Well, she's very good. I love her in
the Thomas Crown Affair.
No, that one's that one's pretty awesome too. No, in Get Shorty, that's my favorite Renee Russo.
Yeah,
with
John
Travolta.
She's just awesome and underutilized and. In virtually everything.
Major League. Also very good in that as well.
She in Major League? Was she the
no,
was she Sheen's girlfriend?
She's in the golf one. She... Oh, in Major League? I was thinking
wasn't
the,
she?
I think she was in the Kevin Costner golf.
She was in Tin Cup. Yeah, she was.
Is that Kevin not Costner's. Her in Major League?
It may be. I don't know. Which one was she? Was she Wild Thing Vaughn's love interest or was she Roger
I
Dorn's
thought
wife?
So. No,
or were
Roger,
they the same character?
Roger Dorn's wife, I thought, was Leah Thompson, was it not?
Oh, hang on now.
So S.H.I.E.L.D. has built this structure, if you will, around the hammer, which we haven't heard the name of the hammer yet in the film.
No, Thor mentioned it, but they didn't know how to say it properly. He mentioned it, and then Kat Dennings had a
she calls it meow meow
moment.
Meow meow
meow meow. Meow.
Yeah. Right, yeah. But when this movie came out, a million fanboys cried out in anguish because they'd been pronouncing Mjolnir, right? Mjolnir. Myself included.
Yes, which is how Nick and I felt when we found out that Mark Millar is not the way you pronounce his name.
Yeah, it's Mark Miller.
Well, look, it's Jasper Sitwell. They just mentioned Southwest Airlines, too, so I hope they got some money for that. But Jasper Sitwell, who is a Hydra agent, but we don't know it yet. Well,
mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. That was one thing that was interesting is seeing him here. I was like, oh, I wonder what Hydra's interest in all this is, because it's always kind of cool to apply that future knowledge to some of these past films. Yeah,
and you go back and rewatch it. Yep. Darth Vader syndrome. Yep.
Yeah, I've always thought of him as kind of like a low rent Jonathan Coachman.
He does kind of look like the coach. coach.
I imagine Jasper Sitwell doing the Charleston, you know.
Yeah, now who would be Jasper Sitwell's rock?
Oh, clearly Samuel L. Jackson, right?
Everybody wants to see you dance the Charleston.
Oh, man.
Jasper Sitwell is just a great name for a character, by the way.
Classic. Now, wait a minute. Okay. Jasper Sitwell, you're cool with, but all the Iron Man names you have an issue with, essentially.
Jasper
not alliterative.
Is the most underutilized name in the 21st century. Sitwell, it's a description of something you could do. You could sit well on something. And you put them together, and it's just a classic name. It's the equivalent of Detroit Lions offensive coordinator Jim Bob Cooter.
Jim Bob Cooter, yeah. That's a good point.
So Thor is raiding the complex now.
Fireman's carry.
He's got a
fireman's carry
poncho on. Oh, there goes the poncho.
It's a very important poncho. He was very adamant about needing that poncho for some reason.
So apparently
he needed to dramatically throw it off.
This kind of reminds me of E.T. at this point with the plastic tunnels and stuff.
You don't have a lot of faces on the shield guys. You just see their boots, their menacing boots and bodies racing places. Kind of like in E.T., none of those doctors have faces.
Right.
Thor with a Walker roundhouse kick there a moment ago.
And as Thor is laying the smack down on these guys, you have...
Here comes Hawkeye.
Yep. You have a Hawkeye ascending to his nest, so to speak.
Agent Barton, as we know him in this. That's all we hear.
Yes.
So it's an Easter egg for comics guys and nothing else, basically.
I have to be honest, though. I know that this whole thing, this entire S.H.I.E.L.D. thing, I agree with Nick. It feels really forced and unnecessary in the movie. Seeing it for the first time in the theater, I kind of marked out for seeing Hawkeye appear. Because you have to understand, in 2011, it was still novel to see these characters cross over with each other. So to me, it was kind of cool to see Agent Barton pop up in the Thor movie. Subsequently, you can look at it and say, well, that's a bit of fan servicey, but in this case, I was okay with it at the time because, you know, I didn't know when I would be able to see these characters for sure again, although I think we did know that the Avengers was eventually going to happen. I don't think any of us knew how well it would turn out.
Yes.
Well, we knew it was coming because of the end of Iron Man 2. It was the first one to use the James.
Well, as soon as I saw Iron Man and Hulk, I was like, this is where they're going with this.
Right, but then at the end of Iron Man 2, in the credits, they do the James Bond style Iron Man will return in the Avengers.
Okay.
And then they do it again here in this one as well at the end of the credits, right before the post-credit scene rolls.
Can I criticize Hemsworth's form on that dropkick? I've never liked that. You know what I'm talking about, Todd, that stampede dropkick where they do it, you know, landing on their back. Never been a big fan of that one.
Yeah, that was kind of a Bad News Allen dropkick, if you will. A Makan Singh or a Davey Boy or a Dynamite Kid. Yeah.
Dynamite Kid dropkick, yeah.
So he's looking at Mjolnir right now, and he's about to lift it because, he should be able to lift it. He's been able to lift it his entire life.
Yeah.
Right. Because, again, this is a version of Mjolnir that the worthiness enchantment had not been placed on it until the events of this movie. So...
And will Barton's arrows have any effect on Thor? We're about to find out, perhaps.
Oh, that's a good face.
Well, and doesn't he just have human strength at this point?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons he was able to that guy, the big S.H.I.E.L.D. agent who just was fighting with him, was able to give him such a challenge is that he has been stripped of all his powers as well. So he is essentially just a very, very good-looking Earthling at this point.
Was that just the "you're big"? Fought bigger part.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, here's a nice Shawshank scene.
Yeah, covered in mud and screaming in the rain.
I wish I could tell you that Thor pulled that hammer.
Come to the desert.
That's what the MCU needs.
In New Mexico, there will be a hammer that has no earthly place.
They should get Morgan Freeman to play, like, T'Challa's uncle or something in the Black Panther movie.
And just have him narrate the history of Wakanda at the beginning of the movie?
Pretty
Let
much.
Let me tell you about the story of your homeland. It was a good homeland. The end.
And so Nathor sees the crest appear on it, and so I think that's kind of his first inclination that his dad has done something to the hammer. What, he's not exactly sure.
The thing that's holding the hammer up, the little mud sculpture there, kind of resembles the clay pot from Ghost.
A little bit, you're right, yeah. Why would they build this multi-tiered structure? Like, what is the utility of the multiple levels?
They just decided to spend an abnormal amount of money to build a structure around this hammer for...
And I've said it before, but I'll say it again. Good Lord, I love the way they handle Heimdall in these movies, because that shot we got of him right there, that's just a really cool visualization of the way that character's always worked in the comics.
Even though, and you guys are much more versed in Thor than I am, it seems to me like it's a little bit of a waste of Idris Elba to have him playing this character, because he doesn't really do anything for the most part. He pops up for like 10 minutes in a movie.
Idris Elba, they were lucky to get him then, but because if they were to cast him now, he would be in a much, much larger role. I think his star hadn't risen to the point that it is 6 years later. But I wonder
Does Heimdall ever do anything more in the comics? Does he have more of a character, I guess, in the comics?
Nope.
Well, I mean, his character in the comics was always kind of the same thing, to be the watcher, to be the watchman, so to speak. But he would occasionally, you know, have some more physical roles. But typically, no, what you see here is kind of a pretty good representation of most of the character's history, with a few exceptions withstanding.
God, this is just reminding me how much cooler Coulson was when he was a character that popped up in the movies, as opposed to a character who was the lead on a TV show.
His character has changed. He talks so much more now. He's just a cooler dude back then, and keeps his cards close to the vest. And now he's Mr. Exposition. He has to drive the story along so much on the TV show that it's
And it's always
annoying.
Everything is a joke.
And he's so much smaller now, you know.
Yep.
Back then he was a kind of almost like Mr. Smith from The Matrix. He's a G-man.
Yeah. Mhm. Mhm. They have humanized him so much, so to speak, that it's taken away everything that made him special. He's just a guy now. He's just some dude that I wish wouldn't talk so much. But that's beside the point, I suppose. Here's Loki appearing to Thor in a vision, just appearing to Thor.
Now, how did...
Dressed very nicely, I must say.
How did Loki get down there? Did he take the Bifrost? What's he doing? How did he do this?
Nick, explain.
Okay, so Loki, at this point in the movie... You know, one of the earliest mysteries, or not really mysteries, one of the earliest plot questions in the movie is, how did the Frost Giants get into Asgard without using the Bifrost, without passing by Heimdall? Later in the movie, Loki is going to make reference to the fact that there are ways of getting around the Bifrost and ways of moving from realm to realm that not even Heimdall can see. And so my understanding is that he is using some of this dark magic here to – I don't know if he's actually physically there, or if he is just, you know, using some sort of astral
dark
projection to appeal
magic.
to appear before Thor here.
Meanwhile, he's straight up lying to his brother, saying, you're worthless. You suck.
Yeah, this is the first moment where you kind of like – you have gotten the implication probably as a more casual viewer that Loki is – clearly trying to play everybody for personal gain, but this is the first moment where you see him outright lying to his brother and very specifically trying to keep Thor away from Asgard for his own gain. So this is the moment that kind of, you know, reveals Loki to the general audience as an out and out villain at this point.
It was me, yep. Thor.
He's like a sexy Palpatine. Yep. He's a sexy Palpatine where you can't really trust anything he says to anybody, because he's constantly playing everyone around him.
Damn it, Greg, now I want Tom Hiddleston for my young Palpatine anthology movie I've been begging for years.
It seems that in your anger, you killed her.
Now she's gone. Or now he's gone. So there you go.
There you have
it. They keep chipping away at the base of where the hammer is, and Loki himself can't pick up Mjolnir.
Right, and he kind of just walks here casually. So that makes me wonder, I mean, it pretty much confirms he has to be using some sort of cloaking spell or whatnot to not be visible to everybody else who is here at this moment. Mm-hmm.
But he's so good. He's slimy.
He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably the best villain of the entire MCU through this point, through current day.
Easily. I'm higher on Ultron than a lot of people are, and I liked Baron Zemo pretty well, but those are the only other two that I would even...
In the movies, yeah, I would say he's the one. I mean, I liked Ultron too, and I liked and also Baron Zemo, but Loki is the one that's the best realized of all the villains. He's had the most to do. You see him, and he's shown that he can play. It's interesting because in these Thor movies, he does have that sort of... that vulnerability, that duality, where you don't necessarily empathize with him, but you kind of sympathize with him and about what he's going through in terms of, you know, he's not just somebody who is evil for evil's sake. But then, as you see him gain power, and when he transitions to the Avengers film, you see a Loki that is almost this bombastic villain who is this just slimy, just classic heel, and he plays that just as well as he does the emotionally tortured heel in the Thor movies. So it's such a great character because there are so many different ways you can play it.
Right. I agree completely. So we're going to get, you know, a kind of a whirlwind of events. You're going to get Thor basically explaining the entire concept of the World Tree to Jane Foster here in a little bit. You're going to get he and Selvig bonding over some drinks. And then eventually you're going to get the Warriors
Foo Fighters 3 playing at the bar. Yep.
You're going to get the Warriors 3 and the Lady Sif coming to Earth to retrieve Thor because they don't trust Loki, essentially. So a lot of stuff that's going to happen here in the back half of the movie. But I'm saying all that because I kind of want to jump ahead a little bit and talk about – I know, Greg, one of your major complaints about this movie is the action, in that there aren't really a ton of great action scenes. I'm a big fan of the Jotunheim sequence from earlier in the film, and a big fan
and that's
of
the
final
first, what 15 minutes yeah
first 15 minutes and I'm also a big fan of the final fight between Loki and Thor, but really other than those two things, the only other fight scene is the Destroyer scene, which is not
in
awesome.
Thor versus the Shield agent.
Oh, Thor versus the Shield agents, you're right. Yeah, good point.
And they're not good. As I mentioned earlier, I was joking about the dropkick thing, but honestly, the choreography was not good in those, pretty much any of these fight scenes. And everybody that listens to us knows I'm huge on action, much more so than Nick is. And I notice things about action scenes that either don't make sense or that are just boring and not kinetic enough for what you want out of an action scene. And I would definitely agree with Nick that Thor is among the worst, probably. It may be the bottom for me of the action, as far as action goes in the MCU movies. There's just not a lot in those scenes. They're not. You can see the effort that went into things like Asgard and the interactions between Thor, Loki, and Odin, which are by far the most important things. But it's frustrating when you see how little effort went into something like Jane Foster's character, or in this case, as we're discussing, the action scenes are just very underwhelming. The Destroyer scene, not good. Not a memorable scene in the slightest.
Which is weird, because you see Much Ado About Nothing, some of the knockdown, drag-out brawls that Branagh conducts between Emma Thompson and himself and Keanu Reeves, I got to say, I would have thought that, you know, that would be state-of-the-art action sequences, but no, apparently he forgot all of those in the 20 years between these two films.
Yeah, I totally agree, Todd. You would think that it would translate, and I don't know if it's because there's so much CGI involved in these fights or what it is, but and it's not just a Thor problem, it's also an MCU problem, because I think a lot of the Marvel movies until recently, really until the Russo brothers, The MCU movies have not done well necessarily with the action scenes, and this is certainly one of the prime examples of that there's not a lot of creativity in terms of making – because let's face it, at the end of the day, these are superhero movies, And one of the things that we've always loved since we were kids in superhero comics is the fight scenes. And it's obvious in a comic when you read an artist that doesn't know how to draw an action scene, and it's obvious when you watch the movies when they don't know how to film and choreograph an action scene.
Right, and probably from a technical standpoint, when you talk about fight choreography, that last fight between Loki and Thor probably doesn't hold up from that standpoint. But I thought, in terms of having a fight scene carry emotional weight, I really enjoyed that one, because you kind of get, you know, this emotional buildup towards Thor finally being able to lash out over his brother's betrayal, and you have Loki basically trying to goad him into doing what he wants, essentially. So I can understand your complaints about it, but like I said, that last one, the fight on the Bifrost, really works for me in a way that it probably doesn't for you.
Yeah, and I'm not knocking it necessarily, the movie itself. I do like this movie, but I do think that that's something that they could have spent more time on, because yes, there is an emotional way. I totally agree there. The acting is phenomenal. The acting, as is the case with almost certainly all the MCU movies that we've watched to this point, the acting really carries it, even when the rest of the film might be almost collapsing around it. The acting is what kind of centers everything, because these performers give their all to these characters for the most part, by and large. And I agree with you on that, but it would just have even that extra little bit of punch for me if the fight scene around it had been better. But still, I agree with you. It's a good scene.
Cassie,
and
go lean
it
crunch.
Is emotional.
Sorry. My OCD requires me to point out any type of product placement. So
yeah, and we're about to get more of the romance subplot, such as it is anyway. But you know, like we said, we probably won't get to the end of this one here. So I think we talked about the final fight scenes. We've talked about a lot of things else. Is there anything else you guys think we should touch on before we bring this part of the show to a close?
Go ahead.
How convincing was the character development for Thor himself for you guys, as far as being humbled? I mean, he definitely starts out as the petulant child, the spoiled brat, and that's convincing. Is there anything in this whole sequence until he becomes Thor proper that stands out to you as him getting it, being humbled and learning his lesson, or does it fall kind of flat?
I think that's a great point that you bring up, Todd, because that's one of my other, as much as I love this movie and I do like it, it's I still enjoy it and I defend it. I think that's one area that they did not achieve, because I think that was supposed to be the role of Jane Foster. I think Jane is supposed to be the character that fosters this transition in Thor's character. But the problem is, she and he are so unconvincing together that at no point in this movie do I believe that she has had any impact on him.
I think she's
just
a robot.
Don't buy it.
She's she's like, I haven't.
It turns out that Jane was a fembot all along.
No, I mostly agree because of the fact that they don't have very much chemistry. But I think that Hemsworth does a good enough job of kind of gradually bringing it from a place of petulance, and then you get his true humility comes when he realizes he's lost the hammer once and for all. Because in that moment there where he drops to his knees at the shield compound, that's kind of the hint that he's pretty much lost any hope of ever getting his life back. And, you know, I think the idea is that later in the film he opts to make the big sacrifice,
right,
because he has nothing to live for. And that, you know, I kind of buy the transition personally, even if I don't think it works as well as they intended it to due to the lack of chemistry between these two characters.
Yeah, and I do enjoy, you know, when the Warriors 3 and Sif come down and they they steal hitch a ride on the Bifrost and they talk and he just doesn't seem – oh, he's drawing out the world tree now, the Yggdrasil, the Nine Realms. I see it when he just sacrifices himself and chooses to just like, all right, leave them alone and give it to me. And I do mark out when the hammer comes to him. Absolutely. I buy into that and I enjoy that. But I just – the chemistry between them is so – so flat, and I don't know. I wish it was
who has more chemistry.
But let's also be honest. Oh. you know, there's a part of you as a viewer who doesn't want to see him transition because petulant Thor has always been the best Thor.
So entertaining. Yeah. But I think it's to Chris Hemsworth's credit, to your point, both of you actually, that even though the transition is extremely rocky, and I would argue to Todd's point that it isn't super successful, I think it's to Hemsworth's credit that I can look past that because I believe him, whether he's being a petulant child or whether he's being this, you know, kind of sweet, heartfelt guy that you see underneath. You see that Thor genuinely is a caring person and he's learned to humble himself. And I buy that from his performance, even if the plot around him hasn't necessarily served that. But I was going to say, who do you guys think has less chemistry, Thor and Jane Foster in the movies, or Oliver Queen and Laurel Lance on Arrow?
Ooh, good one.
I'm going to go Thor and Jane Foster just because, you know, towards the end of her tenure, Laurel had gotten to a point where it wasn't that bad.
Plus, like, they weren't forcing them to be together for the entire run of the show. It was like they were exes, and then there was maybe a little bit of shared moments between them, but I did hate that how like they tried to make it like you were always my true love when she died. But,
so. Right. Well, I thought it was to their credit that they if you watch the early episodes of Arrow, they were definitely trying to force it, and it felt like they realized it at a certain point and they backed off of it completely at a certain point because they kind of realized, oh god, these guys just don't have any chemistry.
They backed off.
Unlike Smallville, which focused on Clark and Lana for like 3 seasons after it was apparent they had no chemistry with each other.
Yeah, I think that's what the internet and Twitter specifically can do to a show, is you get instant feedback of when something's just not right. And, you know, you get people that just – the fandom can really point out to you when something's just not working, and you get that real-time response that somebody's saying, this isn't happening. Man, Jamie Alexander is so good as Sif.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, absolutely. I hope I would love – it'll never, ever, ever happen. But I would love for Sif to get her own movie or TV show.
I think you could do it as a Sif in the Warriors 3 movie, or maybe a Netflix miniseries or something like that. I think it could work.
Be better than humans.
I don't know that they would ever give her one solo, but her and the Warriors 3 off doing stuff together could be really cool.
I don't know. You say that now, Todd, but when Jim Ross gets cast as Black Bolt, you're not going
to
feel that way.
But then he won't get to talk, Greg.
Oh, no, but what they're going to build up the whole season to when he finally utters the word that destroys all foes in his presence, when he just goes, "Ma," and that'll be that'll be it. You'll look up to me and shout, "Save us," and I'll look down and whisper, "Ma."
Did the God of Thunder just make everybody breakfast?
Yes, he and Jane Foster cooked everybody eggs together, which was somewhat unique. But
an exciting scene. In any event, we should probably get to our final points here. So in the end, let's first talk about what do we think of the movie overall? I think it's pretty clear that we all like the movie. Todd, what are your thoughts on this movie? And what were your thoughts initially after seeing it? And what are your thoughts now in retrospect?
I was rather worried the first time I saw it, just because I didn't enjoy the Asgardian stuff as much as I would upon later viewings. Again, I was still of the mindset that, like, well, I could have cast the better Thor. I thought I was still hung up on Alexander Skarsgård being a better Thor and all that. But the more I watch
at least it wasn't Triple H.
That's true.
Let's just
take
solace in that fact.
I could see them using him on a sci-fi version, you know, of Thor, because he's basically a public domain character at this point. But it is funnier than you would think, although I'm sorry. I wanted Volstagg to be even bigger too. He should have been fatter and even more larger than life. And the Warriors 3 worked pretty well. The Asgardian stuff, with all the gold, with all the Shakespearean dialogue, and especially Hopkins' performance, are outstanding. I wish Rene Russo had been given more to do. But overall, the film holds up pretty well. And as far as the 4 MCU movies at this point, it's a strong number 2.
Yeah, I agree with most of what you said. You know, I walked out of it, as Greg can attest to, and I was very, very pleased with what we got. And I would say that I've seen it several times since then, and I think I enjoy it about the same level as I did before. Maybe a little less, just because I think I was kinder to the Earth stuff than I have been in recent years. But all the Asgardian stuff is fantastic. The performances are great for the most part. Hiddleston and Hopkins, as we called out, and of course, the revelation that is Chris Hemsworth and Chris Hemsworth shirtless at various points throughout this film. You know, I just think the film's biggest accomplishment, in my opinion, though, is the fact that it has a Herculean task in front of it in terms of trying to get an audience to buy into and understand all these weird out there concepts. And I think it does about as good a job of introducing all this mythology as you could possibly do in one movie. So to echo what Todd said, for me, you know, again, looking through it, looking at it through a little bit of some Thor colored glasses, so to speak, I think it's, to this point, the four we've watched, it's a strong number two. I would go at this point, Iron Man, Thor, Iron Man 2, The Incredible Hulk.
Seconded there.
As everybody knows, my tastes are a little bit different on the Iron Man movies, so I am going to go Iron Man 2, Iron Man, Thor, and The Incredible Hulk. I've enjoyed all of them. I enjoyed this one. To me, the Iron Man movies are a little bit more engaging for me thus far. So going to be interesting to see how these, as we keep mentioning, it's going to get more and more interesting as we progress through the MCU, how our rankings ultimately will end up. Because I do really, really enjoy this one. Not so much the Destroyer here, but yeah, I enjoy
especially about this. I think next month is going to be very interesting, Greg, when we have Tim on to talk Captain America: The First Avenger, because as I've told you in private conversations before, I think The First Avenger is the one that has improved the most on subsequent rewatches for me, because I walked out of my first viewing of that one saying, well, that was all right. And every time I watch it since then, I've enjoyed it a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. So I'm eager to revisit that one next month. But that's next month.
That's next month. That's right. As for now, we're coming up on a break. And before we get there, I just want to say thank you, Todd Weber, for joining us. Todd, of course, is the host of Conversation Comics. He's also the editor, the producer of all of our podcasts here at Place to Be Nation Pop. Todd, thanks so much for joining us and talking a little bit about this movie. I hope you can come back and join us again in the future on this series and maybe some of our others too.
You're welcome. I think I'm just going to finish watching the movie even after we're done recording the podcast, just because I want to keep my eye open for the Walt Simonson cameo and all the little things. The post-credit sequence, which is...
Oh, yeah. Well, we forgot to mention that. The post-credit sequence with the first MCU appearance of the Cosmic Cube. So that's kind of an interesting thing, although they renamed it the Tesseract for whatever reason.
The Cosmic Cube does kind of sound like something that Conan would have jokingly said on his show back in the day. The Cosmic Cube! So I can kind of see why they would rename it the Tesseract, even though it's, you know, weird, but...
Well, in any event.
Jamie Alexander. Oh, if you would ever do a drinking show, or not a drinking show, a drinking game. Nick and I do a drinking show every time, I think. But if you were ever going to do a drinking game based on this, so every time they say Bifrost, you'd have to drink. Every time they say Einstein Rosenbridge, you'd have to drink. Let's see.
Oh, that's pretty.
Oh, and there's a burger. Good. And every time there's product placement, you have to drink, I think. So you'd be well drunk. I keep seeing Mountain Dew, and there's State Farm in the background. There's a lot of product placement in this film that you don't notice unless you're looking for it.
Todd trying to kill us all with a Thor drinking game. But before we let the people go, Todd, do you have anything you want to promote or tease coming up here on the feed? I know you're in the middle of your conversation series with Tim Capel about the Claremont X-Men.
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm working on right now. And in a couple weeks, we're going to reconvene and go a little bit deeper into the Claremont Burn run. And we're going to talk about the Proteus/Mutant X saga and hopefully get into the little Hellfire Club era of the Claremont Burn. But it's been a great run, a great series that we're talking about. We may stretch this out till May or so with all the stuff that's coming up.
Yeah, you guys are actually – your series that you've got is doing a lot to bring some attention to that run for people who, you know, have never had a chance to read it before. I've talked to several people who have commented that they're now going to go back and read these Claremont Burn classic comics that they had never considered before.
And
so,
again, if you don't have Marvel Unlimited, you should get Marvel Unlimited, because this is the kind of thing that it's made for, you know, to go back and find these. It's not a hidden gem by any means. It's one of the most influential things. I just saw a Southwest.com billboard in the background there. but anyway, so yeah, working on that. And I also listened to a heck of a podcast that I'd like to plug. It was Andy Helene and Tim Capel talking about WCW music. I just listened to that yesterday and today on Place to Be Nation regular feed. And what a great podcast that was. That was awesome.
Including the staggering revelation that Chris Benoit's WCW theme song has lyrics.
Yes. There were lots of revelations that I learned on that one. So it was great.
I literally had never heard that. So
guest starring our old friend Glenn Butler from our feed, aren't
you? Yes.
So those are my things to plug. I'm Todd Weber Guitar at twitter.com. No,
something
that's,
along
that's
those
not
lines.
Right. If you want to at me, bro, it's not at twitter.com. What the heck was that? What is Natalie Portman's shirt? She's got like a sun with a cloud and then these two legs walking. Did anybody notice that?
No.
Look at her t-shirt that she's wearing in this scene. It's really random and bizarre. It's a sun, like a cartoon sun, and then a rain cloud underneath, and then two misshapen legs walking in either direction. It's like, what on earth is that shirt all about? So I'm sorry.
That's for David's podcast coming later about hairstyles and shirts in movies.
Anyway, thank you for having me on. I turned this into maybe more of a Mystery Science Theater version of Thor than we normally would do
This was great.
This is awesome. And actually, we can go ahead and I think officially announce that we will be having Todd back on in a few months for a look at Thor the Dark World, the sequel to this one.
I will definitely be on for that one.
Yeah, Todd is going to be our Thor correspondent. Yeah.
And we're going to have Tim on for Thor the Dark Passenger. So stay tuned for that one as well.
Is that the all anal Chris Hemsworth one?
You're Thor. I'm so Thor I can barely piss.
As I said before, when it comes to Chris Hemsworth, consider my ass thoroughly unguarded.
Ass is very good. I like what you did there.
Thank you.
In any event, we hope you stay with us through the commercial break, ladies and gentlemen. Stay tuned for that. And when we come back, we're going to have Reading, Watching, The Rundown, and all sorts of great goodies.
Reading and watching. You been reading and watching?
David Sunday's Thunder. I like it.
What you been reading and watching?
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, geek, and sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's conversation, and imaginary stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easy to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys, we hope you enjoyed our conversation about Thor with Todd Weber, a movie that we all three greatly enjoyed. But let's move on to the huge around here. And as you know, we've been away for the holidays. You heard our big year end episode last week, but Nick and I have been away from the recording booth for a little while now. Due to Christmas, New Year's, things like that, but we're back, and we've encountered some comics over the last couple weeks. Not maybe as many as we would have liked to, but that being said,
speak for yourself, sir. I've got a giant stack here. I got to work through
a giant size stack.
Not a giant size stack, just a giant stack. Completely different.
Completely different. Totally different things. Two different dolls. In any event, we're going to start off with your favorite segment and mine.
Read out and watch out. Watch you be reading and watch out.
What you been reading and watching?
That's right, folks. We're going to get you started this week with reading because, as you know, we ain't been watching a damn thing.
So, not a thing.
So, and quite frankly, that's our right, quite frankly. And so we're going to get right into the reading portion of our show. Now, full disclosure, I only read three new comic books over the last couple weeks. So I'm going to have my top three. I won't have a bottom one. And none of the books I read were bad, so I couldn't fairly do that anyway. But we're going to go ahead and get cracking with our top three. Nicholas, do you want to get us started?
Sure, why not? Coming in at number three for me, and remember, this is because we haven't recorded in a little bit, these are going to be my top three books from the last 2 weeks as opposed to just the last week. But my number three book is Wonder Woman number 13. This picks up where 11 left off, with the revelation of the truth behind Wonder Woman's complicated relationship with her homeland of Themyscira. And we kind of get a lot of the emotional fallout of that here, and we see how it has affected her. And we get this really beautiful narration from Steve Trevor, where he's written this letter to Diana, apologizing for something and just saying that he can't, that he has to do what he has to do and all this other stuff. And at the end, you get a big reveal of what kind of the status quo for Wonder Woman is going to be going forward. It's very interesting. And I'm interested to see how they're going to tackle some of the themes and some of the issues that, it would seem like it are on deck for the next storyline of Wonder Woman, some stuff that isn't typically done very much in superhero comics. So Wonder Woman 13 continues the tremendous momentum of this book.
Yeah, definitely has been one of the most consistent books in Rebirth, perhaps the most consistent, some would say. Every issue, pretty much, I found something to love, and definitely looking forward to seeing where this goes, looking forward to picking up that issue myself here in the very near future. On to my number three issue, and this would be the next chapter for me in the Phantom Lantern saga. I've been behind on Green Lanterns, the comic, and this would be Green Lanterns number 10. This is part 2, I believe, of the Phantom Lantern story arc, and this continues the wonderful development of this is part 1 of the Phantom Lantern. This continues the development of this Phantom Lantern character, Frank Leminski. Continues to build him into one of the most intriguing new villains we've seen in quite some time across the DC Universe. I know that you've talked about how well he's been developed, Nick, and I definitely see what you've been talking about, because this was not as strong as the issues surrounding it, but still a good issue and a good usage of this villain character. You see his internal monologue, and Jessica Cruz gets a great moment with a little girl that kind of almost feels like a way of addressing that segment of the Green Lantern fan base that resents Jessica Cruz for some reason. Because the little girl character says, "I never believed I could be a Green Lantern before. Now I know I can." And I thought that was a really cool moment. So Green Lantern's number 10 comes in at number 3.
A great segue there to my number 2 book of the week, because my number 2 is Green Lantern's number 13. This is part of the Phantom Lantern story that kind of puts Frank on the back burner for the time being. And it tells a lot of the flashbacks of the early days of the character Volthoom and his interactions with the Guardians, and almost in a way adds to Geoff Johns' final Green Lantern story by adding more emotional weight to Volthoom as a character, and helps you to understand what his motivations are a little bit better than Johns even did with the character. So it's always cool when you can add new spokes to the wheel, especially if those spokes enhance Geoff Johns' story, which is hard to do. But this story continues to impress a lot. I'm loving this new Guardian character of Rami. And like I said, Frank and Volthoom are carrying the day right now. The Lantern franchise is at a high point, the best it's been since Geoff Johns left Mythos, in my opinion.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be the consensus. By the way, a related note, I finally picked up Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 3 today, thanks to some friends of mine. So I will be catching up on that in the very near future. Looking forward to that.
Over the next 3 months or so, yeah.
So let's quiet you. Let's move on to my number 2 book of the week, and let's stay with the same theme we've been talking about, the same book we've been talking about, Green Lantern's number 11, part 2 of the Phantom Lantern story arc, and it is phenomenal. This any other week, this probably would have been my number 1. It was a phenomenal way of introducing Frank and showing that he, like so many of the classic villains, he views himself as the hero, and he's trying really hard to be what he thinks a Green Lantern is supposed to be. And all the way they're showing little hints of maybe why Frank wasn't chosen to be a Green Lantern, because there's a little bit of that ego there. And yeah, there's ego in all the Green Lanterns, but there's a little bit of the selfishness there. Like when he rescues this little girl from the storm, and or maybe it's a little boy, I can't remember. I think it's a little boy he actually rescues from the storm, and the boy doesn't immediately thank him, and Frank actually pauses and says, a thank you would be nice. And it has this kind of annoyed look on his face, which the artist of this one is Robson Rocha, who's been doing a lot of these Green Lanterns issues, and he's tremendous. Does a great job. Some of the facial expressions sometimes are a little weird, but he does a great job with these action scenes and with showing Frank just being completely oblivious to how obnoxious he's being at times. But he's trying to do good things, so that people will see that he's doing good things. So it's just a very multi-layered character. They're doing a wonderful job of showing why the public may trust Frank at first more than they trust these two new Green Lanterns, so to speak, in Jessica and Simon. I'm really enjoying this arc, and I'm anxious to catch up with where Nick is, because it's been great so far. Even a brief cameo by Batman here, as he stops, as you see a glimpse of the Batcave, when he sees Baz on television, and he starts coaching Baz on how to handle the media. So, really good stuff.
Absolutely. My number one book of the week, speaking of Batman, comes from, for my money, the best Batman book on the stands right now, and that, of course, is Detective Comics number 947. This is the finale of the Victim Syndicate storyline. All the characters on the team really kind of get a moment to shine here in terms of showing you, you know, what their motivations are for being heroes and why they care about Gotham so much. But also, two major things I want to talk about, one being the character of the first victim. You know, it would have been expected for them to basically explain the character's entire backstory here in the story and kind of put her off to the side. But it certainly seems as if the first victim is going to be a major character in this run going forward, and there are still a lot of unanswered questions surrounding this character. And I'm interested to see what James Tynion IV has in store for us whenever he chooses to finally make those reveals, especially considering the fact that, you know, there was so much buildup surrounding the Joker reveal from Justice League 50 earlier this year. And in my opinion, because they haven't done anything with it yet, having three versions of the Joker actually takes a little bit of the mystery away. It's cool to have a new character in the Batman mythos that you don't really know anything about. You don't really know how they're going to respond or kind of what their motivation is. So it's cool to have that element of mystery back in it. But the biggest thing I want to talk about is the new role they've defined for Stephanie Brown going forward. I don't want to spoil anything, but it makes complete sense. It seems like a natural extension of what they've been doing with her character. And it sets her up in a very interesting place where she's not really a hero and not really a villain, but she's kind of got her own new agenda. And I'm interested to see how she and Bruce will interact going forward, because it's very clear based on the end of this book that they have not seen the last of each other. So Detective Comics continues to have massive momentum, and I highly recommend this to anybody who's even the most casual of Bat fans.
Would it be fair to say that she's not a bad guy and she's not a good guy, that she's the guy?
She's the guy, indeed.
Very good. I'm looking forward to catching up on Detective as well. I got a little behind of it during the Monster Men arc, so I'm looking forward to catching up on all of that. Moving on to my number one book of the week, and this is kind of becoming a recurring theme here on my list with kind of trading places with Superman at the top each week. That would be Deathstroke number 7. This is the continuation of this epic masterpiece that Christopher Priest has been building since the first issue of Deathstroke. The over-encompassing story arc being known as The Professional, and this is beginning the concluding, I guess, act of The Professional story arc, and we're getting into the home stretch here of this arc, and just really, 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 really well-written. Well written. The layers that keep unfolding. It makes me, you know, it's a good book when it makes you want to go back to the beginning of the run and reread the whole thing up to this point to see how all the pieces fit into place. Continues to have a little bit of that trademark humor that has been present throughout the Deathstroke series, although this one has less of that than any of the other issues. It's the least funny of Christopher Priest's Deathstroke issues thus far, but it may be one of the most intriguing yet because of the layers that get involved here, involving Slade Wilson's wife, Adeline, who we now learn is working for a governmental agency that is trying to recruit Slade into the fold by going through incredible measures that are beyond even what Deathstroke himself would consider to be morally acceptable. So, really, really intriguing family dynamics. You see just how effed up the Wilson family is. Not just Slade, not just Adeline, not just Rose, but even Jericho himself is messed up, as we have continued to learn in this story. And this sets up what I can't wait to see, a conflict between Superman and Deathstroke. Because if there's one character that Deathstroke has no chance to defeat physically, it's Superman. So I'm really excited to see. It's almost like one of those classic last page reveals where it's like, oh, shit. And then it's like, how in the world are they going to get themselves out of this one? So I continue to be really blown away by this series. And I would urge anyone who maybe got lost in the early issues or didn't give it a chance to at least get the trade when it comes out, because I can only imagine how great this is going to read in trade, because it's really playing out like one of those great television series that maybe doesn't hit its stride until towards the end, but when you go back, everything makes sense. A little bit of Justice League Unlimited perhaps in there. So really digging this.
Good to hear. Moving on to my bottom book of the week. Wait a minute. Yes, my bottom book of the week is going to be Civil War II, number 8. You know, this whole event has just been somewhat unique, as we said on the year end, the 2016 year review show. And now that this one's finally over, I can say that at least it copied the original Civil War in terms of having a complete cop-out ending, because you have Captain Marvel, who has acted like a complete fascist, essentially, during this entire story, beat Tony Stark within an inch of his life, only to reveal that, no, he's not dead. He's not dead. He's just in a coma because he experimented on himself and gave himself the ability to somehow put his body into a regenerative coma of some sort. It makes no sense whatsoever. You also have Captain Marvel being offered essentially the Secretary of Defense job and a bunch of other just really weird stuff going on in this book. You have the character of Ulysses, who is just introduced for this story, becoming a Celestial somehow. You have all these other characters being shown all these different possible futures. Essentially, Civil War II was criticized by us, you know, for perpetuating the constant state of Marvel events. And essentially, it seems like all that Civil War II did was set up the next six Marvel events, essentially. It really was a poorly conceived book. There were some decent issues in it from a writing standpoint, but from a plotting standpoint, there was no reason for this story to ever exist. And, you know, I'm a Bendis guy. I love me some Brian Michael Bendis, but it probably would have been better if this one was just left in the can, you know, left in the can all along, instead of being ushered about in 2016 for the shameless cash grab to coincide with the Civil War film that came out this year. So Civil War II, number 8, for all those reasons, is my bottom book of the week.
Tony is in a coma, which is not to be confused with a comma, which we are familiar with being writers. So that's good at least. No, I'm interested to see what reaction is to this last issue of Civil War, because it does indeed sound somewhat unique.
Somewhat unique. All right, and now prepare yourselves for this metric ton of quick hits that I have, considering the last 2 weeks have been very heavy releases for me, but I'll try to work through these as quickly as I can. Star Wars number 26 tells a fun, awesome Yoda story. Can't wait to see more of this. More Yoda is always good, in my opinion. Aquaman 13, the deluge, picks up a little bit here with the Justice League visiting Atlantis and being convinced to help Arthur out finally. Very much enjoyed this.
Deluge.
Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 11. We get more Larflees, and more Larflees, as Greg will attest, is always a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
The only counterpoint is, you know, apparently in order to get our Larflees, we have to swallow the bitter pill of Kyle Rayner along with it. The Mighty Thor number 14. I love this little League of Realms concept that Jason Aaron introduced way back in God of Thunder. I like seeing him back. Malekith continues to be a very charismatic villain that you love to hate. This book's got a lot of momentum. It's picked up a lot from its initial story arc now that it's back to more of its God of Thunder concepts. Star Wars Dr. Aphra number 2 continues to move this story forward. 000 BT once again steal almost every scene they're in. This might be the most fun Star Wars book on the stands right now, so I would suggest, I would highly recommend it to those of you who even partially enjoyed the Darth Vader series. Green Arrow number 13. Green Arrow continues to be very, very good. They set up a very interesting story here where Ollie is essentially being framed for a lot of murders that he's not committing, and they're promising big reveals coming up pretty soon. Batman 13. Got to knock this one a little bit in that it doesn't really – the I Am Suicide storyline doesn't really have an ending, because its ending is Bane coming after Batman, which was the entire point of the story, I was under the impression. So look for the I Am Bane follow-up coming up in the next few months. Trinity number 4, after a couple of issues that focus largely on Superman's backstory, or Superman's past and Batman's past, respectively, we get a Wonder Woman flashback here where the Black Mercy is showing her images of Themyscira. And it actually kind of ties into what Greg Rucka is doing over in his Wonder Woman run. So a great example of DC's tight internal continuity right now. All-Star Batman number 5 wraps up the initial story arc in a very impressive fashion, in my opinion. Even if this version of Two-Face is a version that I've never really read before, Snyder has a very unique take on the Harvey and Two-Face dichotomy that it's unlike anything I've ever read. I'm probably going to go back and reread the storyline now that it's kind of wrapped up, just to kind of catch everything that was going on. It's a very dense read. There's a lot going on in every issue of this one. Titans number 6. Just a great Wally West focused book. I think, Greg, you will particularly enjoy this one. It almost reads, there's a scene that almost reads a little bit like a farewell to the Linda Park that we once knew, but it has the tease of the fact that, you know, perhaps not all is lost, because there is still this current version of Linda, and Wally, you know, has the opportunity to at least rebuild some of what he's lost. A little for here, Justice League versus Suicide Squad 1 and 2. This has been a fine read so far. Nothing groundbreaking, nothing spectacular or anything, but a solid, fun DC event comic to this point. Intrigued by Mark McClure's involvement and want to see more about these characters, because they kind of gave him a C-list roster of characters to align himself with. Spider-Man number 11, one of the weaker issues of this series since its relaunch, in that it focuses almost entirely on Miles' father, Jefferson. And, I mean, he's a fine character, but I read this book for the Miles Morales, and other than the final page, there is no Miles Morales in this title. Action Comics 970, continuing the Men of Steel storyline. Greg, I think you're a little bit higher on this one than I am. I'm just kind of underwhelmed by the characters of the God Killers, the antagonists they've set up for this. Although they do introduce a cool concept near the end, in that Luther is actually put on trial, and it's kind of interesting to see how that plays out, and specifically what Clark's reaction is to that. Teen Titans number 3. Continue to enjoy this book, but I will say that this is the first issue since the departure of Don Boy Myers on art. And this new person, Pham, who I'm not really familiar with, Pham, I'm just going to say it because I don't know the person's first name, just has really weird facial structures here that don't really make a whole lot of sense and kind of break up the flow of the book for me. So while the writing is pretty good, the art just kind of was off-putting for me. And finally, Superman number 13 continues a story that involves Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, and his bride. And so characters I don't really know a whole lot about, and so it's a really weird, it's just kind of a concept I don't really know or honestly care that much about, so it felt weird to have it dropped in here in the middle of my Superman title. So, yeah, Superman 13. And that brings it into my metric ton of reading.
And there you have it, folks. Like we said, we've not been watching anything, we've not been playing anything. So we don't really have a whole hell of a lot else to talk about. I will say, over the break, I had a chance to rewatch Captain America: Civil War on home video for the first time. My father had not seen it yet, and he was a huge fan of it. My mom was a big fan of it. I was a big fan of it. Again, I stand by it as my pick for the comic book film of 2016. So that's pretty much all I've watched comic book related. Do you have anything, Nick?
Not a thing. So with all that being said, we're going to be moving on here to the rundown. And Greg, I think you've got a new little aspect of the show you wanted to introduce to the people.
That's right. Along with noted Jingleheimer, David Sunday, we've developed a new song for the listening public to introduce a little segment here we call the Rundown. So listen to this one and give us some feedback through the Place to Be Nation comics page, comics Facebook page, and let us know what you think of this new jingle. So here it goes, people.
Hi, folks. Engineer Todd here. We had hoped to have a new jingle for you, but it did not arrive in my mailbox in a form that I could use. So this will be our interim jingle. Rundown. It's the Rundown. Yeah.
And so there you have it, the debut of the new jingle for the Rundown. And hopefully all of you out there will enjoy it as much as we enjoyed recording it. So with that being said, the Rundown is here this week. And Nick, I'm feeling a little bit under the weather, so if you wouldn't mind taking over kind of introducing our variety of topics here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we want to open here with a story that's only tangentially related to comics, but it's something that I feel like we need to talk about or at least address here. And that's probably the biggest news item in the nerd community over the last 2 weeks. And that, of course, being the passing of original Star Wars star actress Carrie Fisher, who died tragically at the age of 60 after suffering a massive heart attack on an airplane. She was hospitalized for a couple of days, and there were various reports about her stabilizing or possibly being able to pull through, and then, of course, she did wind up passing away. And so I just wanted to take a moment here and kind of, you know, open the floor for you and I to kind of to comment in brief. I'll say this, and this is pretty much all of it, you know, because there have been so many people at this point who have said things so much more eloquently than you or I possibly could. 2016 was an absolutely terrible year for celebrity deaths, but for me, this was the only one of the year that really hit me in a big, huge personal way. Like it definitely feels like a huge part of my childhood, not even my childhood, my adulthood at this point is gone, and that really sucks. It makes me even more ecstatic that we got that opportunity to see Leia and Han together on the screen one last time and in The Force Awakens, and just, you know, Carrie Fisher was a woman who meant so much to so many for so many different reasons. You know, Star Wars, obviously, but she was also an outspoken advocate for mental health issues. She was a noted script doctor. Excuse me. She did tons of uncredited screenplay work. She seemed like one of the genuinely good people out there, and those are tough to find these days. And, you know, of course, she wasn't without her issues. Notable struggles with drugs and alcohol during her life, but rest in peace, Carrie Fisher. You know, she was hugely influential on me as a child, and I hope that there is a generation of young girls who will be able to continue to look up to her, and that her roles will live on in the years going forward.
Yeah, totally echo a lot of your comments there. She was hugely important. She's a part of American pop culture that can never be taken away. Everyone in that original Star Wars cast now is part of pop culture, not just in America, but in the world. Globally, she's an icon. She turned this character, Princess Leia, into something that would be remembered for generations, for decades, probably for centuries to come. And it's a huge loss. 60... Most importantly, 60 is way too young for anyone to die. She still had much more to give, much more vitality in her, and it's just terrible for her family. It's terrible for the fans, and I wanted to throw a little bit of love to so many of us have focused on her role as Princess Leia, but just as important to me is what was the role that she played in some of my other favorite movies. In the Blues Brothers, she has a role as Jake's embittered ex-girlfriend, and it's one of the more memorable stretches of that movie. She's great in that. She was always so funny. She's one of the funniest people in Hollywood and has been throughout her life, and she got to showcase that in The Blues Brothers, where she does a great job in that. And then even though it was later in her career and she's not a big part of it, per se, a big role in the movie, but she did have a prominent role in one of my favorite comedies of all time, Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery, where she plays the therapist for the evil family therapy session, and she's just wonderful there, and it's a huge loss, and my hope is that people will explore all of her work and see just the depth and the versatility that she had as an actress, as a comedian, as a writer too. I regret to say I haven't read much of her work, but from what I understand, her writing is phenomenal, and I look forward to reading her books one day. about her own unique upbringing. So, anyway, rest in peace, Carrie. We will always remember you.
Absolutely. Moving on to something that's a little bit lighter in tone, and also tangentially Star Wars related. You know, DC's Legends of Tomorrow, which will be coming back fairly soon from its mid-season break, has recently announced that it will be featuring as a character in an episode a young George Lucas. Executive producer Mark Guggenheim kind of laid out the concept of the episode. Here's what it is. The time aberration that occurs in episode 209 is that George Lucas winds up quitting film school. As a result, he never makes Star Wars or Raiders of the Lost Ark. As a result of that, Ray Palmer, who became an engineer because he was inspired by Star Wars, and Nate, who became a historian because he was inspired by Raiders of the Lost Ark, slowly start to lose their brilliance because those things that inspired them to become who they are no longer exist. And so the team is tasked with going back in time and convincing George Lucas to stay into film school. Greg, this sounds off the wall and awesome.
Awesome. Yes. I was about to say, this is exactly the kind of insanity that Legends should be tackling. Such a great concept. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how they can pull this off. And I also think it's a really nice message because one of the things that I think people have seen across the board in society, I've had conversations with people about it as well, is this idea that the arts are less than, that the arts aren't as important as STEM, as some of the other things that we focus on in education. And I think something like this showing the value that the arts have in inspiration and aspiration is really important. And doing it through the lens of Star Wars is a really clever way to do it, and can't wait to see some of the jokes that they work in here too. I'm sure they're going to have a ton of allusions to these properties that are going to make fanboys delight. So, looking forward to that.
Absolutely. Staying in the world of television, let's move over to Marvel Television and a show that neither you nor I are watching. And that show, of course, is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which in the season that's currently ongoing, it featured the character of Robbie Reyes, the modern-day incarnation of the Ghost Rider. And they kind of did an extended story arc with him. And much to some people's surprise, they kind of wrapped that up in the first half of this season. Well, according to co-showrunner Jed Whedon, one of the reasons for that is because there started to arise some budgetary concerns due to the fact that we're having to pay for the special effects shots of, Reyes's consistently flaming skull. They say that it wasn't all due to finances, that there was also a feeling that they could wrap up the story in a logical way, but they did not deny that that there were financial considerations in play when making this decision. This is very interesting to me, Greg. It's one of the few times that I've ever heard a television producer openly admit so soon after the fact that finances played a major role in altering the show's storyline. So I kind of wanted to get your feedback on it. I know neither you or I are watching it, but a little concerning if Marvel is, or if Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is having such big budgetary concerns at this point, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I don't want to comment on the quality or lack thereof or whatever of Ghost Rider because I haven't watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. this season. But what I can comment on is my concern, which is I don't think it's a good sign anytime you commit to a concept and then abandon it because you can't afford it. My thought process is this should have been a conversation that was had in advance saying, okay, should we even try to do Ghost Rider? How much is it going to cost? How much is it going to cost to make him look good, to do it properly? But once you decide to do Ghost Rider, I feel like you have to do your story arc as it is. You can't then cut bait halfway through and say, well, we can't afford it anymore, so it's time to, wrap it up. That kind of is a bad precedent to set, and it's kind of a catch-22 because we have been very critical of Supergirl and Legends of Tomorrow at times for the CGI, being really bad. And so I guess that's the trade-off of you're gonna have really good CGI, but you're gonna run out of money for it. And your choice is either to have the CGI be less than to finish off your story, or just finish off the story earlier than you planned on. And I guess it kind of depends on where you fall on that. I haven't watched it, so I don't know how it ended from a narrative standpoint. I would say that because I'm a writer maybe by trade, that my preference would be to stick to the story, even if you have to stomach a few episodes of less than stellar CGI to get to where you're going. But yeah, it's definitely a tough situation to be in. But it begs the question: it's not like Marvel has any shortage of great characters that haven't been on screen yet. They didn't have to do Ghost Rider. They could have done another character that would have cost less money. So I don't know. I'm kind of, to borrow a phrase, I'm of two minds about it. So what are your thoughts, Nick?
You know, like I said, I think it's a little bit concerning if budgetary concerns are playing such a big role at this point. You would think that, you know, with the combined forces of Marvel and ABC behind it, that I won't say that money should be no option for the show, but it's a little worrying when what should be a relatively simple special effect to pull off in today's day and age is becoming such an issue. So, you know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has kind of gone through kind of a little bit of a roller coaster ride in the ratings. Some people are not positive whether or not that it's going to be back for another season after this. So I'm very interested to see what the future of the show is. But speaking of the future of shows, why don't we talk a little bit about our boy Jeff Johns? And he, on January 1st, sent out a series of tweets. And I wanted to talk about two. And this series of tweets was intended to tease some things that were coming up over the next calendar year. The first thing we're going to talk about here is he is saying that there is going to be more DC TV. He mentions, of course, The Flash, Arrow, Gotham, Legends of Tomorrow, Lucifer, and Supergirl, of course. But then he also says, and many more, one of which will be announced soon. He gave no further details, but it would seemingly be in addition to those already in development. Greg, it's time for Russell Sellers' favorite segment of the podcast, Baseless Speculation. What do you think the show is? And what do you think the show is? And two, what would you like to see the show be?
Okay, I'll start with number one. I think the show is going to be the long bandied about Titan show that was originally scheduled to go to TNT. Perhaps it still is going to go to TNT. I don't know. It could maybe go to CW. It could go to TNT. It could go to another network that we haven't considered. But I think it's going to be the Titan show. As for what I would like it to be, I think it's hard for me to say because, man, it would be awesome to see Nightwing in live action. But I'm going to say I would like it to be the previously rumored Booster Gold show that was originally planned for Sci-Fi several years ago. So those are my two picks. I think it's going to be Titans. I wish it was Booster Gold.
I'm going to say that I think it's going to wind up being Justice Society of America, considering you already have somewhat of a backdoor pilot for that earlier in the season of Legends. Mm-hmm. I would like to see it be – oh, man. Oh, that's tough. I would like to see it be a Secret Six show. How about that?
Ooh.
There's an outside-the-box choice.
Ooh, and then you could do a good version of what Suicide Squad could have been.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, I'll throw out my pie-in-the-sky idea that we talked about on the phone earlier today. A Star Trek Deep Space Nine-style Green Lantern Corps TV show that would be set in Warrior's Bar. Run by Guy Gardner, of course, and it would basically deal with the interminglings of the various Green Lanterns and aliens that interact at Warrior's Bar and some of the conflicts that arise out of that. I think that would be incredible. I think it would be a big, big money investment for special effects, potentially, but I think it could be done on television if they used practical effects because it wouldn't be big, you know, space battles necessarily. It would be more of the interactions of these characters. So that would kind of be my pie in the sky idea, but there's no chance of that ever happening. So I'll stick by Booster Gold.
Absolutely. Like I said, though, the television-related tweet was not the only tweet that Jeff Johns sent out. He also said that the number one thing he is looking forward to in 2017 was the fact that he was going to be writing comics again. And that tweet was accompanied by a close-up image of the eyes and forehead of one Dr. Manhattan, seemingly confirming that Geoff Johns follow-up to his DC Universe Rebirth number one is coming this year. Some are taking it to mean that simply means he's going to start work on the project in 17, while others believe that means the project is coming in 17. I think it's probably more likely that he's going to start work on the project in 17, because as we'll discuss in a few minutes, there's another major DC event that's already slated for later this year, and I don't know that they would want to put those two back to back, so to speak.
Yeah, I think you're on the right track. I think he's going to start working on it in 17 and probably try to finish it for 18. Although, you know, no knock on Jeff, because he's balancing 1,000 different things now. But we've been waiting on that Aquaman event for, 4 years now? So, 3 years now. So, referring to the follow-up to Throne of Atlantis, you know, Rise of the Seven Seas.
Right.
So, we still haven't gotten that. And I'm going to go ahead and say it, man. I want my Batman Earth 1 Volume 3. So, I'm hoping that he gets to work on that sometime soon. Because I'm super, super excited for the potential of that. But, yeah, no, anytime Geoff Johns writes an event, I'm going to be there. He's, to me, ever since Day of Judgment, anyway, he's batted 1,000 on his big event books. So really, really excited to see where that one's going and to see how the Watchmen characters play into it and how he writes the Watchmen characters. Cause that can be tricky. As you know, whenever you try to capture another writer's voice, for a character that is so distinct and so unique, we've seen this with various writers doing Harley Quinn over the years, trying to mimic the way that Paul Dini writes her, some successfully, others not. So it'll be very interesting to see how this is pulled off. I have nothing but the utmost faith in Geoff Johns. I think he's the best in the biz. So excited to see where DC's going in the next couple years.
Absolutely. You know, and like I said earlier, one of the reasons I don't think this is coming in 17 is because of another major DC event that we got a little bit more information about over the past couple weeks, with the announcement that Greg Capullo has officially signed a contract to return to DC Comics. He is going to reunite with his Batman partner Scott Snyder on a summer 2017 DC event title. And they did a little bit of an interview with CBR to kind of talk about the event a little bit. And I want to read you this quote here from Snyder, who's kind of explaining the concept of the event. He says, and I quote, "Greg calls it our Batman heavy metal rock opera. It's going to be a big, epic Batman story with flaming armor, an over-the-top capstone to a lot of the stuff that we've done with him. It's all mapped out. I've just been out to Burbank with Geoff Johns going over it and going over what he's doing. It was great. It's one of the best story meetings that I've ever had. We sat there for a couple days and really tightened up some of the screws. Geoff was incredibly generous and helpful with it." So, Greg, what do you make of all this?
There are two or three aspects to this that I want to address. First of all, awesome. Snyder and Capullo, the best Batman team of recent memory, coming back together to do a massive event book. I'm super pumped for this. I've been waiting for these two to do a book beyond just the scope of Gotham City for a while now. So excited about that. Area two, Scott Snyder and Geoff Johns. In my opinion, the two preeminent DC writers of the last, I don't know, 5-6 years, coming together on a story and bouncing ideas off each other. Yes, please. Very excited about that. Item number three, my little bit of hesitation. As you know, Nick, I think I'm kind of like you in this regard. I tend to prefer my Batman-centric stories to be a little smaller scale, unless it's a Justice League story where he's part of the ensemble. So flaming armor and dinosaurs and lasers, as Scott points out in the interview. I don't know. It sounds a little Morrison-esque potentially. So, which is fine for a lot of people, but is not necessarily great for me when it comes to Batman events particularly. But I get the impression that it's a line-wide event that is just going to be based in what they were doing in Batman, maybe.
Right. And I'm kind of like you. That worries me a little bit in that it doesn't really seem necessarily in Snyder and Capullo's wheelhouse. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're both amazingly talented individuals who can do anything they set their mind to, but dinosaurs and lasers and over the top wasn't what drew us to their Batman in the first place. You know, it was the introspective nature of it. It was how dark and gritty it was at times, and the amount of character development that they were able to pull off over the course of their run. And I don't know that out of control dinosaurs and lasers and over the top necessarily screams character development to me. But all that being said, it's these two guys.
They've earned
no
the benefit of the doubt,
yeah,
for sure.
Exactly.
And I'm
There's
excited
no
to
chance.
See what they do. I will say, perhaps somewhat controversially, that for me, I think if ever their Batman run slipped, it was when they got too over the top. Whether it be the Mr. Bones arc,
the Mr. Bloom arc.
Well, the Mr. Bloom arc, but the who's the Bones guy that was in the middle of Zero Year, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah, I got you. Yeah,
I can't remember the character's name, but that was probably the low point for me of their otherwise stellar run on Batman. But I'm looking forward to it. At the very least, it's going to be entertaining. We know that.
Absolutely. And so we're going to touch on one last story here for the rundown on this episode, and it's also a Batman-centric story, but it's focused on Batman on the big screen. And that's during some of the promotional efforts for his most recent film, Live by Night, the Batman star and director, Ben Affleck, gave some quotes that seemingly, you know, kind of make it seem as if the Batman may not be the sure thing we once thought it was. In response to a question about them filming The Batman later this spring, Affleck gave the following response, and I quote, "That's the idea, but it's not a set thing and there's no script. If it doesn't come together in a way that I think is really great, I'm not going to do it," end quote. Greg, what do you make of this? I mean, I understand that he's kind of been consistent all along in the fact that until the script was right, he wasn't going to make the movie. But does it not seem to you like Warner Brothers in a hurry to get this done, in a hurry to make this movie, and it maybe Affleck is pushing back a little bit on that?
Yeah. It seems to me like a little bit of posturing on his part. I don't know whether that's to get more money. I don't know whether that's to get the attention of the studio or to get the attention of somebody affiliated with the production. I don't know if that alludes to some sort of issues with the script that he and Geoff Johns have been working on. I don't know any of those things. But I don't think that they would be this far along and that they would be I don't think they would have formally announced his attachment to the project if it weren't a virtual certainty that it was going to happen. So I have to feel like this is just some sort of posturing and some sort of gamesmanship here. I don't know what message he was trying to send, or maybe he's just trying to keep things close to the vest for now, and you know, leave some surprise for people when they when the announcements come. But I have to believe that he's going to make this happen, and that they're gonna make it worth his while to make it happen. Let's put it that way.
Well, I mean, on the same level, though, you know, you say this might be some posturing on his part. Do you not think that the announcement from DC Comics and the rumors that have kind of been leaked out about them wanting to release the film in 2018 and take the place of Justice League 2 on the schedule, do you not think that could also be posturing on the part of Warner Brothers to pressure Affleck into making the movie sooner rather than later?
Possibly. I think that it could also be a situation where the leaks were not supposed to get out, and that Affleck was not happy that the leaks got out about that. Particularly that they're trying to get the movie done quicker than anticipated. And one thing that we've both said from the get-go about all of these DC movies is you cannot rush them. If you rush them, it's going to be a disaster. And as much faith as we have in Ben, as much faith as we have in Jeff and everyone associated, they cannot let the studio push them around on this. Every other DC production since The Dark Knight, with the possible exception of Man of Steel, has had at least some level of the studio inserting itself into the production. They cannot let this happen with Batman.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. Well, with all that being said, that actually brings a close to this edition of The Rundown, and with it, this episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
That's right, folks. We've finally reached the end of our show. We hope you enjoyed our look at Thor as we continue our way through the Hard Travelers for Hire journey through the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We also hope that you've enjoyed some comics over the last several weeks. A lot of major releases coming out. Civil War II coming to an end, as Nick referred to earlier. I apologize. I've been feeling under the weather this week, so my voice was in and out. But definitely thank you for sticking around and listening to the show. And, Nick, why don't you tell the good folks out there what they can expect in the coming weeks?
Sure. You know, for the rest of the month of January, we're going to be going through what Greg termed a somewhat attitudinal month, as we're going to be taking a look at things that, you know, kind of stick in our craw a little bit. And one of those things that, you know, Greg and I are not exactly overly prepared for next week, but we'll figure it out over the next week how we're going to do this. We're planning on doing a long book hunt on the somewhat controversial Frank Miller follow-up to his seminal work, The Dark Knight Returns, that, of course, being The Dark Knight Strikes Again. I have read this book. I don't believe Greg has ever read it before. Is that the case?
That is correct. I have not.
So it'll be very interesting to see, you know, his thoughts and a little bit of my thoughts on that one. After that, we're going to be looking at an off the page on one of my favorite animated series of all time, of course, Ultimate Spider-Man. Going to be doing that. And then we're going to be wrapping up the month with a countdown of our bottom five DC comic stories of all the times. So big month, you know, the next 3 weeks coming up here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Absolutely. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter. I am at G Phillips, G-P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S, 8652. He is at Nick Duke, N-I-C-K-D-U-K-E, 87. And you can also, we highly encourage you to join up at the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just type in Place to Be Nation Comics in the search bar on Facebook. It'll pull us up. Join the page. You'll be approved. We have all kinds of fun conversations there. Talk about the shows, talk about comics, talk about TV shows, talk about movie news, whatever you want there. And, of course, we do have PTBN email addresses. Greg P. at placetobenation.com, Nick D. at placetobenation.com. Send us your thoughts, your praise, your criticism, whatever you have, suggestions for the show, books you'd like us to review, new segments you'd like us to debut. We're always receptive to fan reaction, basically. We're a listener-driven show. And again, rain or shine, we'll be here next week doing our best to hopefully to entertain and to bring some maybe some insight into some of our favorite and least favorite things in the comic book world. Stick with us, folks. Enjoy going back to work, as we all are this week. And try not to be hellishly depressed as I am at the moment. So, anyway, thanks for listening, folks. Nick, do you have anything to sign off with?
No, of course not.
There you have it. We are eloquent as always here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Y'all have a good one. We'll catch you next week.
Nasty. Hey, listen to the man.
Well, Godfather.
Payback.
Cold blooded.
Before we go under, down low. People, people, we got to get over before we go under. Hey, country, you didn't say what you meant. You just changed a brand new funky president. Stock market going up, jobs going down. It ain't no funky job to be found. Heck, I keep going up. I changed from my glass. Now I drink from my paper. Getting bad. People, people, we gotta get over before we go under. Listen to me. Let's get together and raise some. Let's get together, get some land. Raise our food like the man. Save our money like the mob. Put up a factory on the job.
Godfather.
Hello. Turn on your funk.
Get sexy, sexy, get funky and dancing. Love me, baby, love me nice. Don't make it once, but can you make it twice? I like it. People, people, we gotta get over before we go under. People, people, well, 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 before we go under. Turn on your funk motor, I know it's tough. Turn on your funk motor until you get enough, yeah. Hey, give yourself a chance to come through. Woo! Tell yourself I can do what you can do.
Hey, listen to the man.
Rap Godfather.
Hey there.
Cold Blood.
Change the things around here.